One thing I do want to do, America, a shout out to the men in uniforms that protect and serve this country. From sea to shining sea, from one white boy to all nationalities, we got to stand together, people. It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 449 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, July 10th. 2016, I am the Solid Monster. Shout out to Joey Numbers of Wrestling Suit. We finally met in the flesh this past week. Joe is in New York for the first time. A true Bostonian, when the waitress has to ask twice what it was that you asked for. I love it. Audible continues to offer listeners of this podcast a free trial of its service. You can try it out right now, free for 30 days, using our URL, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. You can sample the service free for 30 days. You can download one free audio book. And even if you cancel your trial in those 30 days, you get to keep that book no matter what. Coming off his big win last night at UFC 200, which we're going to talk about here in a second, Brock Lesnar, you can get his book using our Audible link. Daniel Bryan, Chris Jericho, tons of other wrestling books if that's what you're interested in. So punch in the URL, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. You have to go through the sign-up process, and at that point, you can cash in on your free audio book, courtesy of The Sound Off. I also want to thank everybody who participated in the sale on Pro Wrestling Tees, the 4th of July sale. We moved a ton of shirts during that sale, and I hope to see a bunch of them in Brooklyn for our meetup at the KBH Beer Hall on Sunday, August 21st. Got to give a plug there. You can RSVP for that on our Facebook page. And I also want to give a shout out to Mia Brown, big fan of the podcast. She put a whole video up actually on her YouTube channel of, I guess you would say, unwrapping or unboxing her Sound Off Girl shirt. She was very excited about this shirt. And I want to just say thank you for buying the shirt. Thank you for the support. You can check out Mia, by the way. She's on Twitter at ChaChaVegan if you want to give her a follow. And if you like what you hear each week, you can consider making a PayPal donation. It's completely voluntary. How much or how little you give is entirely up to you. But $10 or more will get you a fun little wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the podcast if you want to hear your name mentioned on the show, which is listened to, by the way, all over the world. So I want to give a shout-out to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Malicious Intent Michael Cuomo, Ryan the Dagger McTaggart, Destruction Jamie Dorsch, Misfit Miguel Mendoza, Severio the Hero Coletta, Super Supreme Gus Gomez, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Your Girlfriend's Crush Gary Smith, The Glendale Golden Boy Zach Thompson, Edwin Pretty Boy Palenzuela, and Chris Ludek, who runs Prime 8 Essentials, offering the best in clean living supplements. Follow them on Instagram, at Prime 8 Essentials. That's at Prime, the number 8, Essentials. So thank you to everybody who made a donation. You could do so on thesolidmonster.com. You can't miss it. The PayPal button's right there on the right-hand side of the page. Just click on that, and away you go. Also, I posted something fun, or at least I think it was fun. That seems to be the general consensus on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thesolidmonster. I hope to do more of them. It was the first time I've ever done anything like this before, which is basically just playing a video game on the computer. In this case, it was WWE 2K16, which I bought a number of months ago. They had a sale. Not a great one, I mean, but it, you know, a couple bucks off. So I bought the game, I played it twice, and it's pretty much just been sitting there ever since. So I said, you know what, I ought to put this to good use. Let's have some fun with this. I have access to my brother's PS4 controller that he will occasionally let me borrow. And, you know, you plug it into the laptop, it works like a charm. The graphics are pretty incredible. It's a fun game. It's just that I don't have any freaking idea what I'm doing. So with more experience, I hope to get better at this. So I basically just played a simulation on WWE 2K16 and did some commentary over it. It was a brief video. It's my first match. I was Stone Cold Steve Austin, the greatest of all time, against John Cena. I picked John Cena as my first opponent. That was my mistake. It didn't go very well for me. In fact, John Cena beat me. John Cena beat Stone Cold with a five-knuckle shuffle. I am ashamed. And I have much work to be done. But you guys seem to enjoy it. You know, over 9,000 views on this video of me playing this game. So there'll be more of them that go up on the channel. And I've gotten a lot of very helpful tips from you guys on buttons to press and whatnot. So we're calling it Sound Off Gamer. And there should be a new video up hopefully very soon. So subscribe to the YouTube channel if you want to be updated on all of that stuff. Now, UFC 200. Their biggest pay-per-view of all time. I would expect it'll do the biggest buy rate of all time, although the last one was UFC 100, which was headlined by Brock Lesnar, and that show did about 1.5 million buys, or maybe 1.6 million or something like that. I think this show has a pretty good shot of breaking that, even though one of their main events, their main event fell apart. John Jones was busted on a doping violation because he's a dope. So, of course, a dope getting busted on a doping violation is not really a shocker. Just a moronic move. Whatever it is that he did, just completely moronic. Here's a guy who's on probation. I mean, he's been in so much trouble. And to me, it's just not even worth dealing with someone like... I mean, how can you trust someone like that? You know, you put somebody in that position, the main event of your biggest show of all time, and it's not like this is the first time this guy is fucked up. I know he's talented. I know he's a young guy. You know, you hate to lose him to a competitor, Bellator, whatever, but how do you put your trust in this guy after what he's done? I don't see it. So that main event went to hell, and they found Anderson Silva. He stepped in there to fight Daniel Cormier, but for about 5 minutes there, Brock Lesnar became the main event of UFC 200, him against Mark Hunt, and then they made the decision to go with the women instead. Amanda Nunes and Miesha Tate was the actual main event. The official main event. Some people still saw Brock as the main event. I guess there were some people, at least, who walked out after his fight. But Brock Lesnar did fight Mark Hunt last night, and he was victorious in his return to the octagon after a 5-year layoff. He won his fight. They went all three rounds. So went to a decision. All three judges had it 29-27 for Brock. I got it wrong. I thought Mark Hunt would knock him out in the first round. I mean, those videos of Mark Hunt knocking people out were... terrifying enough to convince me that he would end this quickly, and he did not. Brock was, you know, I'm watching Brock in this fight, and I'm thinking to myself, man, this Mark Hunt guy. Again, I was watching these knockout reels, these highlight reels of all these knockouts of his over the years, and it's like he has to stay far away from that right hand. And it almost looked like Brock, he was very, he knew that. Clearly he knew that, and he was very afraid to kind of go in. But he did take down Mark Hunt a whole bunch of times and was kind of grounding and pounding him there for a while. And Brock took some shots, you know, at the post-fight press conference. I think it was his left eye was all swollen, all black and blue and swollen shut. But other than that, he came out of it pretty well, you know, aside from the eye. I don't think there was any sort of injury. He was happy. He seemed pretty pleased with how things went. He was beating the hell out of Mark Hunt there. At one point, he was beating him so bad, I thought that, you know, there was going to be a stoppage. He was just pounding him in the head. And at the post-fight press conference, he was talking about that. And he said, you know, this guy's got a coconut head. I was doing everything I could to just pound him. Well, of course, he's Samoan. See, it's not just a wrestling stereotype. These Samoans, man, they've got hard heads. So he beat him pretty good and went to a decision. He didn't finish him, but... I thought overall Brock looked pretty damn good. You know, he went out there. He's a gigantic person. I mean, so is Mark Hunt, but Brock is just a gigantic, scary man. And he looked a lot better than he did in his last few fights in the UFC. You know, obviously he's talked about the illness and he was sick. He didn't look sick here. He's older, but he didn't look sick. And his post-fight promo with Joe Rogan, which you heard part of at the beginning of the podcast... That was probably the last promo I would have expected from Brock Lesnar. He didn't say much, but he said, I have one thing I have to say. And of course, he gave a shout out to all of the officers across the country. But, you know, he's just talking about, I'm a white boy and we've got to just band together. I'm like, wow, this is an inspirational message here from Brock Lesnar. And I'm watching this and I'm thinking to myself, you know, is there a way that we could vote for Brock in this election? Because this election is, I'm not too thrilled about this presidential election here, but, you know, Brock Lesnar, if his name was on the ballot, I would find it hard not to vote for him, especially after that little speech there at the end. So anyway, he got paid $2.5 million for this fight. Big payday for him. That's per the Athletic Commission there in the state of Nevada. $2.5 million. That doesn't count any money. I'm sure he must be getting on top of that for cut of the pay-per-view. I don't know what their arrangement is, but it's a bare minimum $2.5 million guarantee that this guy's walking away with, which is not a bad chunk of change for one fight. I don't know what he makes in a year in WWE, but you combine those two things, and Brock Lesnar will end up having a pretty good 2016. And who the hell knows? Maybe he'll fight again this year. I mean, that's going to be up to Vince McMahon. Somebody had emailed me and said, well, isn't Brock's contract up after WrestleMania in Orlando next year? And it's not. If you remember when he re-signed with them, I don't know if he actually said this or if this was just rumor. Brock may have just said it, but when he re-signed with them before WrestleMania 31, it was supposedly a 3-year deal, which means it wouldn't expire until WrestleMania 34. So he's locked into a contract with WWE. You know, I know at the press conference last night after the pay-per-view, Brock was saying, look, Brock Lesnar is going to do what Brock Lesnar wants to do when somebody asked him about that. At the end of the day, he's bound by a contract. He needs Vince McMahon's approval if he wants to fight again. I think it's pretty obvious watching him and listening to him. This guy wants to fight. He wants to fight again. He had so much fun. And I would expect that Brock Lesnar is absolutely going to fight again in the UFC. It's just a matter of when. And is he going to have to wait out his contract? Or is Vince going to let him go and fight? That really is the question. I think Vince will let him fight. I don't know when, but they've got a big pay-per-view coming up later this year, I think in November here in New York. Their first show ever at Madison Square Garden. They've been trying to get into New York for years and years and years, and they finally got, they finally got approved here in the state of New York. MMA was officially legalized earlier this year, finally. So they're going to have a show at MSG at the end of the year. Brock didn't get hurt too badly in this fight. Maybe he could fight it at Madison Square Garden. I mean, that would be gigantic. That would be a show that I would want to try to go to, although I'd probably have to sell my firstborn to get a ticket to that show, and I don't even have any kids. So who knows? I mean, who knows what's going to happen? It really is just dependent on Vince McMahon and WWE, and if they felt they got something out of this that was worth it, because it's always a risk. I mean, Brock could go in there next time and be completely embarrassed. You know, somebody asked him about fighting Cain Velasquez. He lost to Cain Velasquez many years ago. I saw Cain Velasquez last night, and that dude is scary. He is a scary, scary man. I don't know about that. But Brock, you know, he's like, sure, why not? I'll fight anybody. I'll fight him. I'll fight anyone. But, you know, WWE, what they got out of it, who knows if there was any exchange of money or anything like that. But what we know that they got was they got a commercial on the pay-per-view last night for SummerSlam, hyping up Brock's match with Randy Orton. And they got a commercial later on for the WWE 2K17 video game, which has Brock on the cover. So, you know, that makes sense to advertise that, given that Brock's in the actual commercial itself. And that was pretty much it. I was very surprised. I don't know if it was Jeremy Botter, one of the MMA reporters many, many weeks ago had said that he had heard that they've gotten approval. He was going to use his WWE entrance music. He did not. He used his old music that he used to use in UFC, which is Enter Sandman. Which, you know, it would have been cool for him to use the music, but whatever, no big deal. Paul Heyman wasn't there. He had already said that there was no point to him coming out to the cage with Brock. Why, you know, is he going to give Brock pointers on what punch to throw? So he was there, but we never saw him on camera. But I was kind of surprised they didn't show anybody from WWE in the crowd. I would think that if I was WWE, I would have wanted, you know, someone to be there almost as like a representative of the company. Maybe not Vince himself, but, you know, Triple H or you know, send some of your guys to the show. If they're not on the road, send some of them to be there in the crowd, you know, get comp tickets or whatever, and then let UFC put them on camera. I was surprised we didn't at least see that. I know CM Punk was there, but they didn't show him, I don't think. So anyway, that surprised me more than anything else. I thought there would be some sort of WWE representation on camera that they would show, but they never did. As far as the pay-per-view overall, because I watched the entire show, I watched some of the prelim stuff, but not all of it. I thought overall, I don't know. I mean, it felt kind of disappointing, I guess. And maybe that's just, and I don't watch every UFC show, but for example, the last full UFC pay-per-view that I saw, I guess that would have been UFC 196, which was the show where Misha Tate won the title, and they had the first Conor McGregor-Nate Diaz fight. And that was an incredible show. I mean, that was that, and I watched that show, actually, it was with some friends. We were at a bar in the city, so I was amongst people, and people were going nuts. I mean, there were a couple of really shocking finishes on that show, but that was probably one of the greatest pay-per-views they've ever had. And so now I watch this, and it's like, oh, this was built up, UFC 200. It's going to be the biggest of all time, the greatest of all time. It wasn't the greatest of all time, but it's a good show. I enjoyed it. I mean, I was a little bored at some points, especially, you know, Daniel Cormier basically just laying on top of Anderson Silva. I mean, look, you do what you got to do to win a fight, but I thought it was fucking boring. So I don't know, a little disappointed in the show overall. But let's switch modes here, back to storyline mode. The other big news: okay, Brock won his fight. He seemed to come out of it, aside from his eye, pretty much unscathed. He'll be fine for SummerSlam. SummerSlam has been saved. He didn't get hurt. And so now it's full steam ahead. It's going to be Randy Orton. Randy Orton is coming back. He was officially announced as Brock Lesnar's opponent August 21st at the Barclays Center. And first of all, let me just say this, because we have the draft coming up in the next couple of weeks. Apparently Brock, I wouldn't expect Brock to be on Raw Monday. Paul Heyman will not be on Raw Monday. I guess he's going to be over in the UK. You would think they'd have Heyman on the show just, you know, singing Brock's praises after what happened last night, but he will not be there. But Brock is supposed to be on the draft show, which I guess is SmackDown July, what is it, 19th, I guess. Brock will be there. Brock will be drafted to one brand or another. He is going to be part of it. I would expect he'll end up on SmackDown. I don't know that. That's just a guess. But I would expect him to be on SmackDown. I would put him on SmackDown. If I'm trying to make SmackDown the strongest show possible, I draft Brock to SmackDown. You know, and it's not like, well, you don't want to put Brock on the taped show. SmackDown's going to be live from now on. I mean, pretty much, it's going to be just like Raw, just an hour less and on Tuesdays instead of Mondays. So in my mind, he's got to be the first round pick, because if I'm either one of these COOs, right, because they're calling them COOs now apparently instead of GMs. If I'm one of these COOs, like in storyline on this show, and I'm put in charge of, let's say, the SmackDown brand, I look at this and I say to myself, this guy right here can make me a ton of money. Because Brock Lesnar's matches, his fights, whatever you want to call them, they're going to be the biggest must-see attraction that you can possibly give in this company. Brock is the biggest star that they have right now. This guy is a superstar. I mean, John Cena, obviously John Cena's a big star too, but I'm just talking in terms of like legit. I mean, Brock is the real deal. There is nobody like this guy on the roster. There's no one who's even close. I mean, he is that guy. So if I'm a COO and I'm running SmackDown, I'm thinking to myself, I want this guy on my brand. Even if I only get him for three or four big matches a year, I get that he's part-time. And if I'm running SmackDown, I would, you know, draft a John Cena or a Roman Reigns number two. You know, I'd still want to grab one of those guys or a Seth Rollins or an AJ Styles or whoever. But I'm taking Brock. I mean, you know, if we're being honest here, we're being real about this, I just don't see how this guy is not drafted at number one. I wouldn't want to let the other guys get him. Now, Orton was announced as his opponent. It was a little weird that they would announce that before the UFC pay-per-view, but I guess they wanted to have the ad for Orton against Lesnar. If I were them, you know what I would have done? You know what I actually think is kind of weird now that I think about it? if they were going to run an ad for Orton against Lesnar on the UFC show, why not just save the announcement for the UFC show? It's possible it would have leaked anyway, but if that was what they were going to do, then shit, why not just save it as a surprise? And I mean, I guess maybe they just didn't want to drive people to watch the UFC pay-per-view. They sure as hell didn't mention it at all on their TV last week. They were promoting it on social media. They even aired the weigh-ins. They were simulcasting the UFC weigh-ins live on the WWE YouTube channel, which was just fucking weird. It was cool. And somebody pointed out that apparently the weigh-ins, the UFC weigh-ins, at one point had more views on the WWE YouTube channel than their own, which is, hey, it speaks to the social media, following that WWE has, I guess. But yeah, it's weird to me that they didn't save that announcement. That would have been a kind of a big splash to make, but I get it. You don't want to let your competitor, but according to WWE, UFC isn't their competitor. So I don't know what there is to worry about. Because you could have made the announcement there and then had ESPN, because they're in bed with ESPN. ESPN on SportsCenter could have mentioned, hey, Brock Lesnar is going to, wrestle Randy Orton now at SummerSlam. Could have even had Randy Orton there. See, that's also, like I said before, I don't, it's one thing not to use the music and all that. That's fine. But why not have Randy Orton sitting in the crowd and at one point have the cameras go to Randy Orton, show him and his wife on camera. He's sitting there watching Brock's fight. It was weird that they wouldn't have at least someone like Orton there in the crowd. But they announced this match before the pay-per-view. And they have a draft show coming up, I guess, in a little over a week. I guess it's a spoiler. We have to assume that Brock and Orton are going to end up on the same show. I guess maybe they won't. Maybe the draft doesn't take effect officially until a certain date, which is ridiculous. Again, I wasn't a big fan of the draft to begin with. We'll see how it goes. Already to me, it just seems weird. Like, you're going to have a draft here on July 19th, but it doesn't go into effect until after SummerSlam for another month because the split brand pay-per-views aren't starting until after SummerSlam, right? SummerSlam's going to have everybody on the same show. I don't know if there'll be brand-specific matches at that point. Maybe there will be. The timing of everything is just very weird. But we have to assume that Brock and Orton will probably end up on the same show. I'm still thinking Brock should and will end up on SmackDown, like Cena and Styles and those guys. The match itself, it's a fresh match. We haven't seen it. The only time they ever wrestled on TV, I think, was in a random TV match back in 2002 when they first broke in, because they broke into the WWE main roster around the same time. And I think here's the way you promote this match. Because Orton is not the guy that I would personally have gone with for Brock. But I can understand not wanting to give Brock a championship match because, you put the belt back on Brock and you're right back where you were before, where this guy only wrestles, two more times maybe this year, and you don't have him for house shows and all that. So I get that. I get not putting the belt on Brock right now. But I look at a guy like Randy Orton, and I say to myself, here's a guy who's coming back from major shoulder surgery. It had to be major because he's been out for... I mean, how long has Randy Orton been out for? It's got to be almost a year. It's been out a long time. Here's a guy who had major shoulder surgery, supposedly has a bad neck. I know when that came out in some of the newsletters, I think Orton posted on Twitter, he denied it, or he denied that he was going to have neck surgery. I don't know that he denied having a neck injury. He denied that he was going to be having neck surgery, because at one point the rumor was, well, he'll heal up from the shoulder surgery and go right into neck surgery. And I think he denied that. But supposedly he has a bad neck. This is his first match back coming off the surgery. His first major match. Maybe he'll wrestle on TV between now and then. And he's wrestling Brock Lesnar, the guy who suplexes people all over the place 10 times in a match. To me, it just seems like a bad idea. And Orton has had other injuries before. Remember, Randy Orton is the guy who once pounded so hard on the mat that he knocked his shoulder out. He dislocated his shoulder. So he's had shoulder and collarbone issues before. And I don't know. To go in there with Brock as his first opponent back seems like a bad idea to me. But it's a fresh match. I want Brock when he wrestles from now on. I don't want to see Brock against Triple H. I don't want to see Brock against John Cena. I don't even want to see Brock against Roman Reigns. And I still figure at some point they're going to, you know, they're building Brock up so much to have Roman beat him, unless Roman has fallen out of favor. And I don't think he has. I think he'll come back and he'll be right back to where he was before. So, but that's a match also that I feel like I've seen. I saw it at WrestleMania. They were part of a three-way, I think, on one of the pay-per-views earlier this year. I want to see Brock in there against new opponents. And Randy Orton is a new opponent. So at least it's someone fresh. And if they're going to do this match, to me, you got to play up their history together. These are two guys who came up in OVW together in the early 2000s. They broke into the main roster, like I said, practically right around the same time. I mean, Brock debuted in, what, April, I think it was, of 2002? I don't have the month in front of me that Orton debuted, but it had to be around that same time, within a few months anyway. So there's a story there. If you want to go back 14 years and tell it, you've got to draw from that history, and I think they will. I think they'll probably put together a pretty awesome video package and show them, you know, in their younger days coming up together. To me, that's the best way to promote this match. You know, you want to just play off the fact that they came up together, they know each other, maybe they were friendly at one point, and play it up kind of like they're playing up the Cruiserweight Classic, you know, which I'm going to talk about later in this podcast, and I love the whole sports presentation of it. I think they should play this match up the same way. And pray for Orton, because this guy has been made of glass for a good part of his career, and I just don't know that putting him in there with a guy like Brock in his first match back is very smart. But also, Orton should not be winning this match, so it's kind of a weird situation, because Brock's coming off a legit win over a big tough guy at UFC, and he's been pretty much, I mean, has he? I don't think he's been beaten since SummerSlam last year. You know, Undertaker beat him, and since then, I don't think he's lost a match. And so whoever it is that you're saving Lesnar for, whether it is Roman or whoever, he should not be losing to Randy Orton. Absolutely not. So Orton in his first match back has to lose, which is kind of weird, unless they do some sort of a fuck finish and neither guy loses, but who wants to see that? So it's just a very weird opponent for him, especially at least the timing of it. It's just very weird to me. But that's how I would promote the match. I'm going to do something I don't normally do, which is A, review TNA, and B, do it before we talk about Raw or any of the other WWE stuff, because I want to talk about the Final Deletion. And actually, I should mention this first. Impact is moving to a new night. They are moving back to Thursdays, starting July 21st from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. That'll be the new time going forward instead of the current 9 to 11. They had to make this move. With SmackDown going live on Tuesdays, it would have been suicide for them to just keep Impact on the same night. So it was a smart move to make. But the thing is, I mean, this show, this Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. It's got to hold the record. It just has to hold the record. In terms of wrestling shows, like major, like national weekly wrestling TV shows, in terms of moving time slots over the years, it has to hold the record. I know SmackDown went from Thursdays to Fridays, back to Thursdays, and now to Tuesdays. But Impact, I looked it up. And this is why I think it just has to hold the record. Find me another show that's moved this many times. So this is across four different networks, no less, okay? Fox Sports Net, Spike TV, Destination America, and Pop TV. These are the days of the week that TNA Impact has aired. Not like a one-off. Okay, these were the permanent time slots for the show at one time or another, going all the way back to 2004. Okay, Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, then moved to Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, and so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, then Friday again, then back to Wednesday, then Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows, right? It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh. And laugh is exactly what I did while watching the Final Deletion. I was thoroughly entertained by the entire thing. I loved it. Kudos to Matt and Jeff, but also to Jeremy Borash for putting that thing together. Apparently, he was pretty heavily involved with the whole production. I've watched it 4 times already. If I tried to watch anything 4 times from that Raw show last Monday, I would want to throw up. That to me is really the best compliment I can pay TNA. They wanted to get people talking, and they succeeded. Mission accomplished. And what did I say when I saw... Remember when I saw that horrendous contract signing segment between Broken Matt and Brother Nero all those weeks ago? It was before Slammiversary. And it was all over the internet. It was all over social media, so I watched it. And I thought it was just... The acting was just cringeworthy. Although, the best part of that whole thing was Matt Hardy trying to roll out under the bottom rope and getting stuck. But I said at the time, I said, you know what? As horrendous as it came off, it got people talking about TNA. But although, again, Matt rolling under the bottom rope and getting stuck was just high comedy. But they wanted people talking about this thing, and they did, and it paid off in the ratings, too. All the promotion for it on social media and whatnot. TNA ended up doing its best ratings since they debuted on Pop TV at the beginning of the year. 410,000 viewers. That was up almost 100,000 from the week before. Now the question, of course, is can they sustain that? Changing time slots is not going to help them. They always lose viewers, at least for a few weeks, when they first change to a new night. So in a way, the timing cannot be any worse for them. Here they have this angle out of nowhere. It's so ridiculous. All these people tune in. They boost the numbers up. And now, not this week, but next week, I guess it's next week, they're changing to a new night. It's like these people can't catch a break. I doubt any of this is going to add any new viewers for Impact. I tried to watch the rest of the show. I just could not get into it. It doesn't help that Josh Matthews and the Pope are painful to listen to. More so Josh Matthews. I mean, just, I don't know, the way that he strains his voice for effect, like, the Pope is going to climb, and here we are on TNA Impact, and Bobby Lashley is like, oh. He sounds like he's trying to take a crap, but doesn't have enough fiber in his diet. I did see a backstage, I will say this, I did see a backstage promo during the show by Bobby Lashley. This was after the stuff that they did with, I think it was after the stuff they did with him and Eddie Edwards. But he was in the back, and Bobby Lashley looked directly into the camera. I was like, it made me so happy. I mean, more than it should have, but I don't know. I saw that, and I'm like, he's looking at me. That's amazing, because you never see that in WWE. You'll see it on NXT sometimes, but you really don't see it in WWE. It's such a simple, stupid thing that, you know, you would think if someone's cutting a promo on whoever, you look into the camera, you direct your promo with them. You don't look off into the distance like you're reading off fucking cue cards. So that was cool. But yeah, I didn't sit through the entire show. I pretty much just watched all the Hardy stuff. And there's been a lot of divided opinion on this. Some of you loved it like I did. A lot of you hated it and thought it was the worst thing you ever saw. For me, it's very simple. And I'm just speaking for myself here. I am amused, just as an example, by a lot of the stuff that comes out of the DDT promotion over in Japan. How can I like DDT and not like the Final Deletion? Right? I mean, in fact, I can remember watching a DDT match in the woods with Kota Ibushi, and I don't know who he was wrestling, but I remember Kota Ibushi on like a swing, and he's literally on a swing, and as he swings, he hops off and gives the guy a Hurricane Rana, and this is in the middle of like the wilderness. I'm like, this is pretty cool. So if I get amusement out of that, how can I not out of the Final Deletion? It's just as wacky and over the top, ridiculous. This was like a DDT match, but with better production values and no blow-up dolls. You know, I'm the kind of person, I can watch Kota Ibushi or Kenny Omega wrestle a blow-up doll in a full-blown match and not get offended by it. I can watch Kenny Omega wrestle a 9-year-old girl and not get offended by it. Even though I'm not a fan of the intergender stuff that Lucha Underground does, for whatever reason, I watched that Kenny Omega match with the girl, and I'm like, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. This is a good match. This is actually a good match. And I know some people will watch that kind of stuff and think this is just the beginning of the end of the pro wrestling business, and it's such an offense, and you know, I know a lot of you would watch that and would be appalled. I know Jim Cornette's head would probably explode if he ever saw that clip, for example, of the Young Bucks super kicking that little kid on his birthday and selling for him. They actually sold for the kid before they kicked him in the face. But to me, it's fun. You know, it's okay to be silly and have fun every now and then. And this is coming from somebody who many, many times here on this podcast, just to give an example, with WWE, when they'll do stupid, silly shit, the problem with them, and maybe it's not, this was more a problem, you know, in the last few years, maybe not right now at this exact moment, but they were always doing this just bad comedy, goofy, silly bullshit on Raw. But the problem is, first of all, what they were doing wasn't funny. Most of the time, it was not funny. And also, they were doing so much of it. It's like, am I watching a comedy show or am I watching a wrestling show? Because a wrestling show could have a combination. It could have a little bit of everything. It can have comedy. It can have serious stuff. It can have this. It could have that. Just, you got to find that happy medium, right? So, I didn't watch every single segment on this Impact show. But I don't think the majority of the 2 hours, aside from the Hardy stuff, I think everything else was pretty serious stuff, right? They had an Ultimate X match. I know they had a whole thing between Eddie Edwards and Bobby Lashley going face-to-face, and is he going to cash in? I don't think any of that was played up for comedy. They saved that for the Hardy stuff, and that's fine. But for the longest time, like with WWE, I would always be like, man, I wish they would get more serious. Because there were not enough things on that show that I thought were being taken seriously. So I am a big fan of serious and all of that, but I can also have fun. It's okay to just kind of let your guard down and just watch something completely stupid and just enjoy it for what it is. And maybe that's why I was able to enjoy this and some people weren't. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what it was. This was so out there. You know, it could go either way. You either love it or hate it. And I fell into the first camp. The Broken Matt character is very entertaining. I think he should do that for the rest of his career. I don't think he can actually get better. You know, if he ever went back to WWE with Jeff, I'm sure they would want to do a Hardy Boys reunion, and it would do well at first. But, you know, it would get old, I think, pretty quick. I enjoyed the Matt Hardy V1 stuff from many, many years ago, but that's also old and in the past. To me, Broken Matt, at this stage of his career, what is he? He's got to be close to 40 now. Just play this up and run with this. This is just a pretty incredible character that he has created for himself here, as ridiculous as he looks. He's a guy who's been driven completely insane. That's the Broken Matt character, right? To the point where even his brother, who's a pretty eccentric guy himself, nobody will look at Jeff Hardy and say he's a pretty normal guy, right? Jeff Hardy is not, he's not normal. And even Jeff Hardy himself keeps, like in these skits, he keeps going, "What's wrong with you?" Even he's like, "What the fuck, dude? What is going on here?" And that was one of my favorite moments of the match itself. When Matt starts shooting the Roman candle at him, and you could just hear Jeff in the background just going, "What's wrong with you?" I laughed. I laughed so hard at that. Some other highlights from this insanity. Let's just walk through this here, because this was something else. I love the little Lucha balloons that they had at Maxwell's birthday party. They were throwing a birthday party for their son. Young Maxwell, I guess, turned one. And they threw a little birthday party for him. And I don't know if anybody else picked up on that, but they had little Lucha, almost looked like the Lucha Underground logo, little Lucha balloons in the background. Broken Matt telling his gardener, who was apparently played by Rebby Sky's father, to prepare the battlefield for Massacre. I thought that was nice. I think that is a perfectly reasonable request to give to your gardener. Jeff Hardy is in his house. He's strumming a guitar when we see a drone outside the house with the name Vanguard 1. Nice little callback there to his Matt Hardy version 1 days in WWE. When Jeff opens the door to find the drone, a bunch of little drones fly in through the back door. And he destroys each one of the drones with his guitar. He is swinging this guitar. And shockingly enough, holy CGI, the guitar is not broken. The guitar is not busted. It's in perfectly pristine condition, even though he's whacking these drones out of the sky. And I would like to think that that's pretty much how Jeff Jarrett would fight off an army of drones if they ever invaded his house. Either that or he would try to sell them gold bars. So then, maybe the best part of this entire thing, Vanguard 1, is now inside Jeff's house. And Broken Matt pops up out of the drone in hologram form, sounding like he just inhaled 2 tons of helium. It's not the only thing he inhaled before filming this, I guarantee you. He informs Brother Nero, that they will have their final battle tonight for the rights to the Hardy brand, whatever the hell that means. And the Broken Matt drone then flies out of the house. But Brother Nero says, "Oh, hell no." I can't even do it the way he did it. He did it in that... I can't do it justice. He's just like, "Oh, hell no." And he has to chase after the drone now. He chases after this drone on his dirt bike. And this allows Broken Matt, back at the house, to ruin Jeff's lawn. All of the great landscaping that he's done. And the sight of Matt on the lawnmower just cackling maniacally will go down as one of the greatest wrestling moments of 2016. I don't care what anybody says. Which brings us to the battle itself. The referee, who... he looked familiar to me, and I wasn't sure if he was a TNA referee or an ROH referee, and I looked it up, and sure enough, it was the same referee who got fired from Ring of Honor for sexual harassment many months ago. So he drives up to this makeshift arena in the middle of nowhere. It's on the Hardy Estate. It's in the woods. He drives up to it in the dead of night, and his reaction, I think, is pretty much the same as everyone's. He's just like, "What the hell is this?" So Broken Matt is in the ring, and there's a ring outside. He's playing a violin. He claims that the violin was personally given to him by his dear friend Antonio Stradivari, which is most impressive, given that Stradivari died almost 300 years ago. And maybe that sheds some light on what time period that awful accent comes from. That might have answered that question for us. So he plays the violin, and Brother Nero shows up. This was literally a backyard wrestling match, but with better lighting. That's what really what this was. And it's the Hardys, so naturally a ladder comes into play, because of course. Jeff took a horrendous bump out of a tree, no less. He climbed up into a tree. He did a swanton bomb out of the tree. Now, you got to picture this now. I'm sure you've all seen it, but there's a really crappy, cheap-ass ladder that they used, and it's laying flat, like horizontally across either the bottom rope or the middle rope, and Matt is laying on it. So he comes out of the tree. He does this swanton bomb, and I don't know if the idea was that he was going to hit Matt or if Matt was supposed to move out of the way, but Matt rolled out of the way. He did not hit Matt. Instead, he hit his shoulder on the ladder on the way down. Just, you know, I'm watching this, and it's like watching old Mick Foley matches. I don't know if you guys get the same feeling when you go back and watch old Mick Foley or Cactus Jack matches from like early WCW or whatever on the network. I can't watch a Mick Foley match now from that period without just sitting there and going, "Why? Why would you do that to yourself?" I over and over again, I think that whenever I watch a Mick Foley match. And that's what I was thinking here watching Jeff Hardy. Why would you do that? Just why? And yet, so here's why I'm not sure if he was supposed to hit him or not, because he takes this horrendous bump, he hits his shoulder, so he hits nothing but ladder on the way down, the edge of the ladder, and yet he goes and covers Matt for the near fall. So I thought that was very weird. This is where Broken Matt now, he grabs a Roman candle, and he lights it with one of the tiki torches that they have surrounding the ring. He starts firing the pyro, shooting the pyro at his brother on the other side of the ring. Jeff could only shield himself with a trash can lid. This was where he yelled at Matt, "What's wrong with you?" which is a perfectly logical question to ask. So Matt now, you know, the pyro dies down. It's just smoke. It looks like a fucking bomb went off. And Matt goes searching for his brother. He's going to finish him off. And what does he find? He finds Brother Nero lighting his own Roman candle, to which Matt says, "Oh, shit," and runs away. And I use that term "run" loosely, because watching Matt Hardy run is funny as fuck. I gotta tell you, it's funny all by itself. And Jeff just goes, "You know, damn right, oh shit," and he starts firing away. Now he's shooting the Roman candle, he's shooting all the pyro out towards Matt. Matt is running away, and in the best moment of the entire segment, he spots a boat which apparently was just a legit boat that was on his property. This was not, they didn't buy a boat and put it there. And because Jeremy Borash, he had done an interview, I guess, on some podcast, and he had talked about this, and he said, no, the boat was on, he was on Matt's property. So Matt's running, he sees this boat, and he just yells, it's a dilapidated boat, and he takes shelter behind it. And you see, you look at something like that, and you can't script that. You just can't. There's just no way that they said, you know, we got to script a great moment with a boat. He just came up with all of this. Like, he's like, fuck, I have a boat. We'll leave it there. I'll go run. Like, he just comes up with this off the top of his head. And it's like, you know, God damn it. This is why I wish in WWE they would let the leash off these guys a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, everything, it just is so forced and rehearsed and scripted and... You know, and it's not a new phenomenon or anything like that. They've been doing that for years. And I still, it irritates the shit out of me whenever people, like on our Facebook page, every now and then I will see the clip that inevitably somebody will link to, it's up on YouTube, of that one time on Raw when Batista was in the back and Batista's getting ready to come out for a match. They're about to go to a commercial break. And all of a sudden, a random dude like runs up in front of the camera, right in front of Batista, and he does like the Batista machine gun pose, and then he goes running and security runs after him. And like, you look in the comment sections like on YouTube and they're like, oh, was this real? Like, this felt real. It's like, really? How gullible are you? You know what I mean? Like, and I think on that same show they had another moment where somebody was doing a promo and like the lighting got knocked over, and this was in a phase that lasted all of 2 weeks on Raw where they were trying to make it feel like, oh, it's unpredictable. Anything can happen. And people buy into it like, oh, man, I don't think that guy was supposed to run in front of Batista. It's like, really? Because that to me came off as some of the fakest shit they've ever done. And for whatever reason, like, I get that vibe a lot when I watch their show. And so when I see something like this, yes, it's crazy and it's wacky and it's like a... I don't even know. You think to yourself, who could come up with something like this? But... little moments like that, I laughed out loud at least three or four different times during this match. And if you put all the segments together, it was at least half a dozen times. So a little moment like the dilapidated boat, like, I can appreciate that because that is just genuinely funny, you know, and it's just a little thing. But Matt drowns his brother in the lake after that, and he thinks he's won, when all of a sudden my favorite character... and you know I say that sarcastically, okay? Willow returns. Yes, Willow is back. He tries to choke out Broken Matt. But the gardener, Senor Benjamin, which is what they were calling him, he comes from out of nowhere with a taser. He uses a taser on Willow. And we lose sight of the two because Willow grabs him by the throat. They disappear. This is like something out of a horror movie, like a B horror movie. And I like my horror movies, so maybe that's why I like this so much. So we lose sight of the two of them. We don't know where they went. Broken Matt now, he grabs a flashlight. He starts looking around. He's looking for Brother Nero. And he finds Willow down, unconscious, on the ground. He grabs the referee, covers him for the three count. He pulls the mask off Willow, and he finds Senor Benjamin under the mask. He's been foiled. So he's screaming no, and Brother Nero, now Jeff Hardy, is back. And they are heading for the final climax of this match. The most expensive acid trip in TNA history. They brawl into the dirt. It's like a giant dirt mound, I guess, where Jeff does his dirt biking. Maybe it was Jeff's property, not Matt's. I don't know. Maybe the boat was his. So they brawl into the dirt. Jeff is choking out Matt. He's got him like in a side headlock. And Matt is out. And because he's Jeff Hardy, that means that he can't just cover the guy. He must climb onto something really, really high. Because he's Jeff Hardy. Can't help himself. So there just so happens to be a giant Hardy symbol in the middle of their backyard. For what fucking reason, I have no idea. But a giant Hardy symbol sitting in their backyard is probably the least crazy thing about the guy. So he climbs up onto it. Rebby Sky hands Broken Matt a lit candle, probably from Maxwell's birthday party. And Matt, who had made sure earlier to have the gardener put gasoline in the dirt pit, okay, he takes the candle, he sets the dirt pit ablaze. Now it's on fire. And the fire is shooting up, and it just knocks Jeff Hardy off. Jeff falls all the way down, right onto his shoulder, right onto the dirt. And Matt covers him, and he gets the pin. And when this match ended, it was already daybreak at this point. Because when the match started, it was pitch black outside. And when Jeff fell off the giant symbol, you could see, like, the sun was beginning to come up. Like, daybreak was upon us here. So they filmed this thing all fucking night. And in the end, Broken Matt defeats Brother Nero and retains the rights to the Hardy brand. So I guess now Jeff has, you know, he just has to go back to being Willow, I guess. This is probably the wackiest review for anything that I've ever done on this podcast, and I'm not surprised it's a TNA segment, but I am surprised how much I enjoyed this. Hats off to everybody involved. I get it now. You know, I didn't get it before. When I watched the contract signing segment all those weeks ago, it was cringeworthy. It was absolutely cringeworthy. If you watch that segment out of context, it's probably one of the worst things maybe that you've ever seen. I at the time I said it wasn't quite that bad. It was just cringeworthy. But you know, I wasn't really following the storyline too much. I knew Matt was kind of losing his mind and all that, but I didn't know why you would take two of your biggest stars, especially Jeff. You know, Jeff Hardy could be a legit top guy right now. Even in WWE, you could just kind of drop him back in there, and he's way up there at the top. And I didn't know why you would take those two guys and turn them into comedy characters. But, you know, I get it now. Matt has lost his mind. And if he was in WWE, for example, there's no way he would pass a wellness test. He is completely out to lunch. And TNA, in terms of the character, I don't mean Matt Hardy behind the scenes, but TNA just let these guys do whatever the hell they wanted to, and this was the end result. It was a combination of Lucha Underground, like a cheap version of Lucha Underground, DDT, and an old Saturday Night's Main Event skit from the 80s. And actually, I mentioned this on Twitter, I was reminded more of not so much Saturday Night's Main Event, but the brawl that Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Harley Race had, and Bobby Heenan was right in the middle of it. They had a gigantic brawl at one of the Slammy Award shows. It might have been the first or the second Slammy Award show they ever did, which was funny because they did I think it was like the Slammies in 87. That's probably the show it was on. But they were billing it like, welcome to the 37th annual Slammy Awards. And I remember the first time I saw that, I'm like, man, there were 36 of these? I didn't even know that. I want to watch them. It took me a while to realize, no, dipshit. They're just saying that. There was only like one before this. This was back when they had the Slammies as their own standalone show, which they could very easily do now with their own network, and they choose not to because they have no creativity. But this giant brawl on that Slammy show between Duggan and Race... they were fighting backstage, and Gorilla Monsoon he's standing there, and he's giving the play-by-play of what's going on, and there were chickens, and there were donkeys for some reason, I don't remember why, but then again, back then in that company, you had bulldogs, and birds, and snakes, and whatever other fucking wildlife they had running around there, so maybe it's not all that surprising, but there they were, chickens and donkeys, and these guys are brawling, and they're throwing makeup in each other's face, and I love that. I still go back and watch that every now and then. I love that segment. I love that whole brawl, that whole fight. And I like this. I like this a lot. So I say well done to everybody who was involved in putting this together. Bret Hart enjoyed his favorite pastime this week, which is berating Triple H. As I've said many times before on this show, if you knocked on Bret's door for Halloween and put your hand out, he would tell you that he has no fucks to give, and he would slam the door in your face. So on his podcast this week, he was talking to his sons about the WWE 2K16 game that came out last year, which I'm only first trying to learn now. It's a good thing I didn't play as Bret in my first video that's up on the YouTube channel. I can only imagine the rant if he saw that he was beaten by a five-knuckle shuffle. Somehow, this video game discussion turned into a shoot on Triple H. And so this is what he said. I want to just read this part of what Bret Hart said verbatim here to you. He said, I went to a thing last fall when the latest 2K game was coming out, they were telling me how I am an 85 or something like that, and Triple H is a 98. I remember I was like, why would he be a 98? And they go, well, because he's the boss and we have to suck up to the boss. He was laughing about it. It kind of pissed me off. I thought, I don't care how many titles Triple H wins, he could never lace my fucking boots up. Period. He was a very good, mediocre wrestler. He never blew me away with anything that he's ever done. He's never come up with much. He's always been a very decent wrestler that could give you a good match. As far as being, like, mind-blowing, I never saw it. I've still never seen it. I've seen him in some matches, and the whole 4 out of 10 thing came out of his match with Brock Lesnar, which should have been a good match. It was a mediocre match, if that. That's where the whole 4 out of 10 thing comes from. He's always a guy that will give you a 5 out of 10 match every night. There's certain guys where you put these video games out, and I don't care. I think if you have to do justice to the wrestlers as they were in their careers. It should be based on reality, not things like who you know in the office. Vince could make him a 35-time world champion, and it doesn't mean he's 35 times better than everybody else that's ever wrestled. He's just not. As far as the games go, I think they should be honest. Someone like Bruno Sammartino should never be a jobber on a video game, so on and so forth. I think you have to pay respect. When I think of a video game, I think about how I'd love to have a Buddy Rogers versus Ric Flair match, something like that, where you can wrestle these legends against each other from different periods and stuff. They should always represent the reality of what the wrestling business is and was. It should also include that respect that the wrestlers have for each other in the dressing room. End quote. Wow. Well, he lost me there. I'm not quite sure how in a video game you show respect, or you show the respect that the wrestlers have for each other in the dressing room. That's a little weird to me. What's next? Are we going to watch these guys showering in the locker room here in these video games? Because if so, I don't want my character anywhere near JBL. You just keep him the hell away from me. I can't even believe I'm talking about this, but I also just spent like half an hour talking about Broken Matt against Brother Nero and drones and holograms coming out of them. So this actually seems pretty normal by comparison. I just think the description for this week's show, once I post it up, it's going to read like one giant acid trip. I think it's pretty clear by this point what Bret Hart thinks of Triple H, and it goes back to the whole Montreal thing. It was Triple H's idea, the whole screw job, and I am sure that is what a lot of this hate is rooted in. He's even let things go with Shawn Michaels. Not that Triple H is the same kind of worker that Shawn was, but Bret Hart will have complimentary things to say about Shawn Michaels. Okay, 20 years ago, you never would have thought that, or 18 years ago, or whatever. But Triple H, he just, every single time I hear him talk about Triple H, it's just nothing but negative, and he just goes all in on this guy. And I'm positive that's what it's rooted in. But he also, I'm sure he legitimately also thinks that for as much as Triple H is played up by the company, as you would expect him to be, he's the game, he's one of the greatest of all time, and this and that, Bret probably looks at him and he looks at his matches and he looks at his work and he's just legitimately not impressed. He just doesn't see what all the hullabaloo is about. And Bret is someone that will speak his mind because he does not give a fuck. And so this is what happens whenever you get him all riled up talking about Triple H. It does not end well. It does not end well, but this is something completely different here, because this was sparked on a discussion about a frickin' video game. You know, I mean, I also think it's pretty clear that once Vince McMahon kicks the bucket and he's out of the picture, okay, and Triple H takes over, we are probably never going to see Bret Hart on WWE television ever again, nor do I think he gives a shit, but he needs to let this video game stuff go. Just let it go. Now, I will agree with him on the Lesnar match being a letdown. He brought that. I assume he's talking about the WrestleMania match that they had in Jersey. Really, I think all of them, all three of them that they had, I thought were just completely boring. I wasn't really a fan of any of the matches that the two of them had. The match that Brock had with Undertaker at WrestleMania, you know, that match at least, it was historic because of the finish. I mean, that was one of those moments that you won't ever forget. But the match itself sucked. Okay, so that to me had to be Brock's worst match since the comeback. But the Triple H matches, in my opinion, they're right behind it. I don't count like the whole thing with Big Show at the Rumble where he just beat him up with a chair. That wasn't even really a match to me. I don't even count that. But if I'm really looking at big time pay-per-view matches, not any of the big show stuff or like the Beast in the East match he had with Kofi Kingston. I'm talking like big time pay-per-view matches since this guy has come back. Aside from the quality of the match with The Undertaker, yeah, I mean, the Triple H matches to me were probably some of the worst ones that he's had. Their two styles, they just did not mesh well. It's not just like Triple H's fault. I mean, it cuts both ways. The chemistry just wasn't there. It just wasn't. So I agree with Brett on that. He gives it a 4 out of 10. I might even go a little lower than that. And maybe I'm being a little too harsh on, I mean, maybe it's not less than, you know, 4 out of 10, but I just was not a fan of those matches. WWE released another one of their fan surveys this week. I didn't get this one, but someone did, and they sent it into PW Insider, a list of potential shows that are under consideration for the WWE network. Absolutely none of these may end up becoming a reality, but, you know, I would expect some of them probably will. They do these surveys for a reason. And I'm just saying, you know, none of these are confirmed at this point, but the list of potential shows reads as follows. Ask Me Anything Live, which is a live interactive Q&A with WWE talents, which is like, okay, whatever. Everyone Has a Price, which immediately got me very excited because I hear that and I think, man, how cool would it be to have Ted DiBiase hosting like a game show on the network? But nope, this is a reality series where they scour the country for the most memorable WWE memorabilia, the origin of the items and determining their price. So basically it's like a WWE version of Antiques Roadshow, which is kind of interesting. Extreme Eats. Tommy Dreamer and Bubba Ray Dudley tour the United States to show off their favorite food locations. Odd and strange food combinations and take part in eating challenges. This I would like to see, just so I could hear Bubba Ray tell fat jokes to Tommy Dreamer. That, to me, half an hour every week would be more than worth my time. 50 States, 50 Dates. A WWE bachelor goes on 50 dates to find romance. This would be a reality show about finding true love while also living your life on the road as a WWE talent. We have Goldberg's Garage. This is one of the more interesting ones here. This would be a reality show about Goldberg, his wife, and their mechanics restoring American muscle cars at their North Carolina garage. And I hear this, and if they're at least considering giving Goldberg his own show on the network, that right there tells you how much things have thawed out between the two sides, even just the last few months. I mean, you know, it was a 2K deal to put him in the video game, but Vince did have to approve that. But if they're considering ideas like this, I think it's safe to say that at some point in the next several months, we're definitely going to see Goldberg on TV, whether he works a match or put him in the Hall of Fame or whatever they do. I think we are definitely going to be seeing more of Goldberg. And even this, I mean, I'm not a big car guy, but this, to me, would be an interesting show for the network. You know, and that reminds me of something before I move on here. And this wasn't on the list, but there was a period, I wish I could remember. I don't know if there was a WWE survey or if this was just something. I don't know if this was something WWE like funded the pilot for or if it had nothing to do with WWE. But I vaguely remember there being some kind of a Steve Blackman reality pilot where he was not a cop, but he was a bounty hunter. Wasn't it like a bounty hunter show where it was Steve Blackman? And I don't know if Al Snow was part. That would be awesome. Al Snow was part of it too, but nothing ever came of it. There was a whole pilot for it that was up on YouTube. I have no idea if it's still out there, but I remember thinking, man, that's a show I would watch if it was on the network. So it wasn't on this list, but if anybody's out there listening, I'm just saying, I think there's a decent amount of interest in seeing Steve Blackman as a bounty hunter knocking people's doors down. I would watch that. So somebody's got to get on that. History of WWE. 10-part documentary series taking fans from the beginning of the company through the launch of the network. Whatever. I feel like I've seen so many history packages and stuff that to me this is all just like I've seen it before. Legends House, Attitude, a sequel to the initial WWE Network series placing 1990s legends together under one roof. I think that would be a fantastic idea. Miz and Mrs., a reality series following Miz and Maryse. I think we can do without that. Talking SummerSlam, a post-pay-per-view... Talking SummerSlam, I get it. Okay, so this is like a Talking Dead thing here. Yeah, whatever. I mean, look, they probably should be doing stuff like that already, so I'm fine with that. Tap Out Fitness, WWE stars share their training tips. The third wheel. Two WWE fans go on a blind date without knowing they are going to be joined by a WWE star. See, this only intrigues me if the WWE star is there to basically kind of rib them and just crack jokes and try to ruin the dates. See, to me, that would be funny. If they're going to be there as like a wingman or something, I don't know. To me, that's not as entertaining. I want them to try to fuck up the date somehow. Totally. And actually, you know what? That it reminds me. I used to watch a show. I have no idea if it's still on the air anymore, and I doubt if it is that he's hosting, but there was a guy, Rich, was it Richard or Robert Loge, or what the fuck was his name? Roger Lodge. That's what it was. Blind Date. I have no idea if Blind Date is still on the air, but I got into that show for a while. I only watched it for a few months, but I wouldn't mind seeing like a Blind Date style show on the network, again, provided that you have a wrestler who tries to somehow fuck up the date. Let's see here. Totally NXT, a reality competition series as six women try to make their way through the developmental system for a chance at a main roster slot and a Total Divas cast membership. Well, you lost me at the Total Divas part. I really don't give a shit about that, but the rest of that sounds kind of interesting. I'd be okay with that. This is the one right here that grabbed my attention the most. The Wives of Flair. A documentary series on the love life of Ric Flair, and his four ex-wives. I don't know if this is just something they stuck in there, or if they're actually serious about this. If they're serious about this, then I would watch. I hope this happens. WWE All Access reality series following main eventers as they prepare for WrestleMania and SummerSlam level major matches, which I thought they already did on the network with that WWE 24 stuff. I thought that's what they did, but maybe not. WWE Game Night. WWE stars face celebrities in games outside the ring, and listed apparently were dodgeball, obstacle courses, and Pictionary. I want a game show on this network, damn it. How do we not have a WWE themed or a wrestling themed game show on this network? This network has been here now for 2.5 years. This is not the game show I want. Give me a real game show. WWE investigates. Each segment would be a 3-5 episode miniseries going deep into a real subject in the history of pro wrestling. The life and legacy of Eddie Guerrero, for example, was suggested as a miniseries. I think that would be awesome. And what I would like to see them do is, you know, don't just, you know, Eddie, you know, a series on Eddie would be great, but I want to see them, if they're going to do something like that, like really go all in. So, beyond the Montreal Screwjob, which we've heard about so many freaking times already, you know what? Go into the death of Bruiser Brody. So you can have a 3-5 episode series where you actually talk about his career and then what happened to him. Because to me, that's a fascinating story. It had nothing to do with them. It's not like it's a black mark on WWE. It's a black mark on the wrestling business. It's one of the biggest tragedies in the history of the business. I would find that fascinating. I would obviously find a miniseries on the Benoit stuff fascinating, although I wouldn't expect them to do that. But I think there are really like legit, serious, real subjects that they could go into here that I think would be pretty cool. So that's a series I'd like to see. It just, like I said, it depends. I don't need one on the Montreal Screwjob. If you're going to do it, you know, do it on interesting topics that haven't been talked about on their TV before. WWE goes viral. Best WWE viral videos, including one submitted by fans. And I think the last one... No, there's a few more. WWE Kids. Eh, whatever. WWE Promo Battle. Talents go head-to-head in an improv war in a tournament-style setting where the audience and the social media... as well as a panel of judges determine who moves forward until they crown a Promo Battle champion. WWE Roast. John Cena would be roasted in a no-holds-barred tribute. How is this any different from the other 364 days a year that this guy gets roasted? That's what I want to know. And lastly here, WWE Superstars Search. Hosted by Lita, and Trish Stratus, a competition reality series where 10 women compete for a WWE contract. Didn't they just list that in this list? Let me see here. Hold on a second here. Totally NXT. Okay, so that's specifically about developmental. Yeah, it's basically the same thing. Yeah, fuck the NXT thing. I'll go with this. Lita and Trish hosting a women's Tough Enough, basically, I think would be a cool idea. I'd like to see it. So anyway, there's your list. They're at least thinking of some new show ideas and concepts for the network. I love the network. I really don't have any... I mean, I can complain about stuff that's still not on there. I wish they would put, for example, Coliseum videos and stuff like that on there. But, I mean, it's a minor thing. There's a ton of really great stuff on the network. It's been over 2 years, and it's slowly, you know, it's beginning to really, I think, take the form that a lot of people would hope it would have. There's some interesting shows. They're coming out with that Holy Foley show, which I'll watch. It sounds kind of interesting. So, yeah, I mean, it's nice to see them, you know, thinking of new ideas for the network, and hopefully we'll get to see some of those things come to fruition. But the Investigate show, that to me, I think, has a lot of potential. But they have to be willing to actually, you know, investigate some of these things and not shy away from things that might make them look bad. I don't know if they'd be willing to do that. Raw last Monday was live from Columbus, Ohio. The Instapoll I threw up on Twitter had almost 2,000 votes. 78% thumbs down, 22% thumbs up. I want to know who those 22% were. I think you and I need to have a chat. This show... firstly, this show hit a new low last week. 1.87 rating. Under a 2. Now, that's on the 4th of July holiday. This was the 4th of July show, which was expected to be low. But that's even lower than normal for a holiday show. It's like the lows keep getting lower. Right? You don't want to sound off the alarm bells just because it was a holiday show, but you can't ignore the fact that these, even the holiday ratings, they are trending lower than they were a year ago and 2 years ago. And yet Raw was still number one on all of cable for the night. But I mean, in a way, you know, it's like Trump declaring victory in the California primary after all the other candidates had already dropped out. You know, it's like, yeah, their names are still on the ballot, but let's be real, the outcome was never really in doubt. I mean, Raw may well have been the only new programming last Monday. I would have expected, I would have hoped that they would be number one, so it's like a hollow win. But when you keep setting new lows and you're about to split your roster in half, this has to be a concern. And lo and behold, they're promoting an appearance by Vince McMahon for tomorrow's Raw. They flash the emergency Nielsen symbol up in the sky to summon the mighty McMahon. Vince is always their go-to guy when the ratings start to go down. They could well have saved him for next week. It's not like this is the final Raw before the draft. They got one more after this, the day before the draft, actually. They could have saved him for that show. But they're trotting him out tomorrow night, and well, I guess we'll see if he makes any announcements about the COOs for the show. I really hope it's not Shane and Stephanie. I know that would be the most obvious thing, and it's kind of been what they're building to. I'm not saying there isn't a story there already, but I don't know. I mean, all of the kind of the going back and forth between them, I'm going to run Raw, no, I'm going to run SmackDown, no, I'm going to run both. And they've been trotting out all the old GMs now for weeks, right? Teddy Long and Big Johnny and Vicky Guerrero. It would be a disappointment at this point for Vince to just show up and be like, I'm putting Shane in charge of SmackDown and I'm putting Stephanie in charge of Raw. It would be a letdown. And I floated my Kurt Angle idea. Maybe it's pie in the sky, you know, him coming back and being the GM of SmackDown. But I hope they have other names in mind other than Shane and Stephanie. And Shane and Stephanie could always be, you know, they could oversee the GMs or COOs, whatever you want to call them. It would almost make more sense to have Shane and Stephanie be the COOs and then have actual GMs that they oversee on the show. Not that I'm a fan of adding more authority figures. I don't think you need any, but if they're going to do it, I would almost do it that way, because if it's just Shane and Stephanie to me, it's a letdown. So let's talk about this show. I'm not going to spend more than a few minutes. I did not like this show, but I must have been in a real wacky mood this week because, unlike a lot of people, I actually enjoyed the food fight that opened the show. I thought it was fun. It's the one thing on the show that I really enjoyed, especially the sight of Kevin Owens hiding under the table eating a bag of potato chips. We had Dean Ambrose and The Miz. It bored me to tears. absolutely bored me to tears. There was nothing special about the match. I'm watching this match thinking to myself, this is the WWE champion. It was just a match in the middle of the show against The Miz. It felt like any mid-card match you would see on any of the TV shows in a given week. Seth Rollins and Dolph Ziggler, I thought they had a good match. Rollins cut a promo afterwards saying that Roman Reigns should be ineligible for the three-way at Battleground, and the fans cheered. Just, you know, what a disaster. But they're still going to try. They're going to try to get people to cheer for him, so good luck with that. The crowd was so quiet during John Cena's promo, which is very rare, because they're always making noise. This was a very subdued crowd for much of the show, and Cena noticed it because he basically called him out for not making enough noise. He was trying to get them going. And, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm just going, like, can you blame them? Look at the show that they've been given so far. Can you blame them for not making any noise? I did think, I have some praise here for this, I did think that this was the best AJ Styles promo since coming to WWE. All the stuff with him in the club about beating up John Cena, which has turned into like a meme, I guess. I thought that was pretty funny. I forgot about that. I did enjoy that. They had Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy save Cena from another club beatdown in a Battleground. They're going to do a six-man tag. It's going to be Cena, Kaz, and Enzo against the club. So they're saving the John Cena-AJ Styles rematch for SummerSlam, maybe even for whatever they end up calling the SmackDown title. Because I expect both of them to end up on the same brand, and I would put them on SmackDown. Maybe it's a championship match. We'll see. But this is a big spot for Kaz and Enzo. You know, I'm happy for them. They haven't been on the roster very long, but they're over like crazy. They're going to be over at SummerSlam, whatever they have them doing in Brooklyn. You know those guys are going to get a fucking hero's welcome when they walk out there. And this match here, you know, teaming up with John Cena, I know it doesn't always end well for people when that happens, but I think they'll be okay. And this is a big spot for them. It is a big match. It's probably the match, one of the matches I'm most looking forward to now on that show. Bray Wyatt challenged New Day to come to their compound for a fight, which New Day accepted, albeit under protest from Xavier Woods. He was not happy about that. And it's like, what a coincidence! What a coincidence, coming off the heels of the Final Deletion, that these two teams are going to have a fight, not in the ring, not in the arena, but they're going to go fight at a compound somewhere. And you know what? Why the hell not? Why the hell not? One of the reasons I love the Final Deletion, besides the fact that I just thought it was funny and it was very entertaining, is that it was something different. And I can't ever fault them for trying something different. So if they're going to actually do this at some compound or something, you know what? It kind of reminds me in a way of a match that they did, which was very unique, and it was a match unlike any that they had ever done before. Almost 20 years ago, almost. It was at a July pay-per-view. I think it was Fully Loaded, which would have been what? That would have been July of 98, I think. It was the dungeon match between Ken Shamrock and Owen Hart. Well, yeah, it had to be 98 because the following summer, Owen was, unfortunately, he was gone. So yeah, it was the dungeon match between Shamrock and Owen Hart, and Dan Severn was the referee. And it was literally a match in the basement of the Hart family home. The old dungeon that we heard so many stories about. Guys getting stretched and abused down there. But it was something like we had never seen in WWE before. And I remember, I think it was it Shamrock or Owen? One of them at one point, like, jumped up, and because the ceiling was very low. I mean, this sounds a lot more impressive than it actually was. But one of them would reach up and grab, like, the pipes were showing, and they grabbed the pipes, and I think it was Shamrock. He did, like, a Hurricane Rana on Owen. It was a very unique match. And the Boiler Room Brawl with Undertaker and Mankind, a match that I loved. I will not fault them for trying something different, even if they did get the idea from somewhere else. The entire show built to a 16-man tag team elimination match pitting Team USA, captained by the Big Show. Okay, Big Show and Kane on the same team. Kane, by the way, who, as many of you pointed out, was born in Spain, not the U.S., and is billed from the depths of hell, which I guess makes him an American. We had Mark Henry, Apollo Crews, Jack Swagger, Zack Ryder, and the Dudley Boys. What a hell of a team that is. Against Team International, which was led by Chris Jericho, who I have to say, has been absolutely phenomenal in this run. I honestly think that it's one of his best. It's probably right behind the heel run he had in 2008. I still put that at the top, but I'm loving the hell out of the Jericho character since he came back. I think he's doing some of his best work. So he was the captain of the team that included Sami Zayn, Kevin Owens, Cesaro, Sheamus, Alberto Del Rio, and the Lucha Dragons, one of whom was born in the foreign nation of Chicago. Team USA sucked. I can't believe that this was the team they put together. It's like they wanted us to root for the foreign team. This was an atrocious main event. Congrats to Zack Ryder. They gave him a win. I saw that on SmackDown he got a clean win over Sheamus. Okay, not even Dolph Ziggler could do that in the 5,000 matches they had. He had new music, apparently, Ryder did. He challenged Rusev to a U.S. title match. I don't know if it's on Raw this Monday or for the pay-per-view, but he threw down the gauntlet. I'm happy for the guy. I'm happy for Zack Ryder. And I think between this, what they're doing with him now, and who knows, the brand split may be very kind to him, but between this and the big win at WrestleMania that he got, this is probably going to end up being his best year yet in WWE, and that's pretty damn impressive for a guy who I thought peaked, 4 or 5 years ago. And not just because he kind of fizzled out, but because the company just lost interest. They gave him like a little mini push, and it ended very quickly thereafter. He was still over, but as the years have gone on, people kind of see, okay, this guy is slotted here, and this is all he's ever going to be, and all of a sudden they're doing stuff with him, and I never would have expected it. So if I have one positive thing to say about this, it's that I'm happy for Zack Ryder, but this match sucked. Sasha Banks against Dana Brooke apparently was set up on SmackDown for Raw this Monday. God help us all. If their little interaction here on this show is any indication, where Sasha went to go kick Dana and missed and she sold it anyway, this match could be a total disaster. I think we're going to find out how good Sasha Banks really is. Or not, on Raw this Monday. And they announced Natalya will face Becky Lynch at Battleground. And that's it. A food fight, and let's all beat up John Cena. Those were the highlights of this show. There, I just saved you 3 hours.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
I thought NXT was a really good show this week. I'm not just talking about the tag title match. This show opened with a match between Bayley and Alexa Bliss and was the best Alexa Bliss match I've ever seen. I thought Alexa looked great in this match. Just technically, she looked great. She always looks great, but she lost, but the improvement has been noticeable. And Bayley, too. Bayley looked good in this match. This is just a good match. I really enjoyed it. After the match, Nia Jax came out. And Bayley had issued a challenge to a rematch last time they wrestled. Of course, Bayley had the storyline knee injury that kept her out for several weeks, and she missed the last TakeOver show. And so now they're going to have a rematch. She'll have her shot at redemption. I don't know if it's next week or not. They didn't announce that, I don't think, but they'll have a rematch soon. We had the Hype Bros against Blake and Murphy, although the match never got started. Blake and Murphy, who are still teaming despite the fact that they no longer like each other, could not even agree on who would start the match. And so Rhino returned. We haven't seen him in a long time. He came back. He gored the shit out of Wesley Blake because even he can't stand this crap anymore. Murphy got away, but Rhino also gored Zack Ryder. He gored Mojo Rawley. That makes Raw, SmackDown, and NXT appearances now for Zack Ryder here this week. It's not bad. It's a lot of TV time. And unbeaten, too. He won on Raw, he won on SmackDown, and this match never got going, so doesn't count as a loss. So that's probably Zack Ryder's best week yet. We got a great video package hyping this Wednesday's match between Finn Balor and Shinsuke Nakamura. Tons of pictures of them in Japan in their younger days. Nakamura looks like a totally different person. Just his transformation has been something else, because facially he looks similar, but otherwise, his hair, the clothing he wears, he looks like a totally different man. Main event on this show was American Alpha against The Revival, 2 out of 3 falls for the NXT Tag Team titles. I made it very clear after the last TakeOver show that I think their match on that show is a match of the year candidate. This match was no different. I probably liked the TakeOver one a little bit more, but this was an excellent match, long match too. And part of what I loved about it is this. So many times, whenever WWE does a 2 out of 3 falls match, and they'll do them every now and then, when they do them on the main roster, it's completely pointless. Completely pointless. It is just an excuse for them to do the first fall in the first 2 or 3 minutes, and then the other guy quickly gets a fall, and it just turns into a regular match. And I'm left thinking to myself, what was the point of even doing a 2 out of 3 falls match if you were just going to get to a regular match in the first 5 minutes? Here, it took a good 15 minutes to get that first fall. These guys, they were kicking out. They were not giving an inch. It was more realistic in that if you had a match between these two teams, and they've wrestled before, it's not like in the past they've had 2-minute matches, right? Why all of a sudden would one of them be so willing to give up a fall in the first 2 or 3 minutes of the match? Realistically, it does not make any sense. Here, it made perfect sense. These guys were having a war. They didn't want to give up that first fall. It's like in baseball. In baseball, if you're a pitcher, you don't want to walk somebody. You don't want to have a leadoff walk at the beginning of the inning, because if you walk somebody at the beginning of the inning with no outs, invariably that person's probably coming home. So you don't want to have leadoff walks. And a lot of pitchers are killed because they give up so many leadoff walks. It's kind of the same thing here, right? If you're in a 2 out of 3 falls match, you're automatically at a disadvantage if you give up the first fall, because then you've got to come back and win back-to-back falls, and that ain't an easy thing to do. So I like what they did here. These guys were going at it for a good 12 to 15 minutes, whatever it was, and there were no falls. And neither team would quit. Dash Wilder did. I mean, he ended up tapping out to the ankle off for the first fall. And then Jason Jordan didn't, you know, he tapped out to a reverse figure four. They had spent the first half of the match basically destroying Jordan's leg. They were just going after this guy's leg. They did everything but rip the damn thing off and beat him over the head with it. And that was the only problem I had in this match, I do have to say. They beat on Jason Jordan's leg, and they beat on it and beat on it and beat on it. And he sold and sold and sold. And then, after he tagged in Chad Gable, within a couple of minutes, there's Jason Jordan on the apron selling nothing. He is standing on the leg, he's not wincing, he's not in pain, he's not favoring the knee. He is standing there, he is dying for the hot tag, because now, you know, Gable's in trouble, and Gable wants to make the tag. And Jordan is just, he is not betraying any sort of facial expression or emotion that would lead you to think that he was in any kind of pain. And this was after, I mean, this was several minutes of the Revival just killing this guy's leg. And Jordan is, or Gable, oh no, Jordan. Jordan is screaming and everything. And I'm looking at this guy on the apron, I'm like, dude, come on. Like, just at least reach down, grab the knee, do something. Like, it bothered me. It was noticeable. It was definitely noticeable. I mean, you would never know that they worked over the leg for a good 10 minutes. Corey Graves on commentary even mentions, before Jordan finally made the tag to Gable, he's on commentary talking about how, well, Jordan's got a bum leg, he's not going to be very helpful. And then, like, Gable immediately tags him in, and Graves looked like a complete idiot because he wasn't selling anything. So I just had to mention that. But finish came when the Revival hit Chad Gable with the Shatter Machine on the apron, the hardest part of the ring. They roll Gable into the ring and pinned him for the third fall. So the Revival wins the match 2 falls to 1. They retain their tag team titles, which to me all but confirms that we're getting an American Alpha call up in the draft in about a week, 8 days, well, actually 9 days from today. On the 19th, they'll do the draft. I expect American Alpha to be drafted. And I'm telling you, have Kurt Angle draft them to SmackDown. That's the way to go. That's what I want to see. So, A-plus main event, big main event coming up this Wednesday, and the first episode of the Cruiserweight Classic begins this week. It'll be airing every Wednesday at 9 o'clock after NXT, so we'll have a 2-hour block of wrestling now, I guess, through September. I watched the Bracketology special on the network, which had Mauro Ranallo and Daniel Bryan as the hosts. They are, of course, going to be the announcers for the Cruiserweight Classic. They already have good chemistry together. I'm sure they'll get better as the weeks go on. I thought this was a really, really good special. They played this up like it was total sport. This was like something you would see on SportsCenter or some UFC hype special for an upcoming pay-per-view where they break down the fights and all that kind of stuff. There was nothing comedic. There were no skits. There was none of that. This was just pure. It's very obvious how they're handling this tournament. They want people to think that this is like a legitimate sporting event. It's unlike anything WWE has ever done before. I mean, they've had elements of sport, but it's always, you know, it's entertainment. It's entertainment. Well, this is not being played up for entertainment. This is being played up as you've got 32 guys. They're being given this opportunity. They come from all over the world. It means so much to them. It could be a game changer. It could be a life changer. They want to win. I love it. I love it. First round matches this week are going... Actually, before I even get into the first round of matches, so they're basically... They were sitting in the Performance Center. They had a little studio set up. You see the rings in the background, and so Mauro is sitting there, and Daniel Bryan is sitting there. And Daniel Bryan, you could tell how excited he is. It's so cool to see because, you know, this guy was down in the dumps only a few months ago. I'm kind of shocked he's even back now. I figured he'd want to stay as far the hell away from wrestling as he could. But there he is, and you could tell, like, he's having a blast, and it makes me very sad that we'll never get to see him against some of these guys. We'll never get to see, you know, Brian go down to do a match or two on, like, an NXT TakeOver special. How fucking cool would that be? But he has an understanding of a lot of these guys because he's familiar with a lot of them. He worked with some of them before. They had Brian Kendrick was kind of in studio. He was sitting there at the desk with them. And by the end of it, because I will say, you know, Brian Kendrick is a very talented guy. And when I heard he was in the tournament, I'm like, okay, whatever. But he's sitting there with Mauro. They're asking him questions. He's talking about how much this means to him. And by the end, I wanted this fucking guy to win the whole thing. You know, and they had a few other people. Triple H made a guest appearance. He was talking about it. They had TJ Perkins, the former Matic from TNA. He popped in. You know, very well-spoken guy, very articulate. Again, his story, he talked about how he was homeless at one point. He told that story in TNA as well. And it's a great story. And you hear these guys and you just want them to win the whole damn thing when it's over. So I just thought this was really well done. It was a good way to introduce us to different people. I learned some stuff about these guys that I didn't know going into it. So the first round of matches, they're going to have about, I think, four of them on the show this week. It's going to be Grand Metalik, who wrestles full-time for CMLL. He's also wrestled for New Japan for a number of years, and that's how he got invited. Finn Balor apparently recommended him. He put a good word in for him, and that's how he got in. So he'll be taking on Alejandro Saiz. This guy cut 30 pounds to make weight in this tournament. They treated the 205-pound weight limit like a shoot. That is a shoot. If you did not make 205, you were out of the tournament. And so he barely made the cut. Ho-Ho Lun, that's his name, Ho-Ho Lun. He started the very first pro wrestling promotion in Hong Kong. He realized that there was no wrestling there at all. So out of high school, he was traveling to different countries and working and learned how to wrestle. He came back to Hong Kong and he opened up his own promotion. And the kid's only 28 years old. Pretty impressive. He'll be taking on Aria Daivari, who is the brother of Sean Daivari of Hassan and Daivari fame. The same Sean Daivari, by the way, who also choked out a dude on a train a few years ago who was acting all crazy. Choked him out and caused the guy to piss his pants. So that should be his brother's finishing move here in this tournament. Choke the other guy out until he pisses himself. We have Cedric Alexander, fresh out of Ring of Honor, against Clement Pichot, I think I'm pronouncing that right. He was trained by Lance Storm, yet another Storm Wrestling Academy graduate in WWE. And lastly, the Brian Kendrick will match up this Wednesday with Raul Mendoza, who has wrestled for AAA and Pro Wrestling NOAH. So I am excited. You should be too. I'm glad WWE is stepping outside of its little sandbox and trying something different. That seems to be the message here on the podcast this week. Try something different. Try something different. Can't hurt. Lucha Underground had its first week of Ultima Lucha Dos. This was week one. Two more weeks to go. We had the Mac and they call him Cage. They opened as part of this, what Dario Cueto called, for a unique opportunity. For a unique opportunity tournament set up by Dario Cueto. Dario said he wants them to replicate their Falls Count Anywhere match from last year's Ultima Lucha. Is it bad that I forgot that these two guys had a match at Ultima Lucha last year? Because I did. So he wants them to replicate that match, and therefore he made this a Falls Count Anywhere match. They brawled all over ringside. Last year, I remember the match. I think it ended up in one of the balconies. They didn't go up there this time. At one point, Mac disappeared backstage. He came back out carrying a bunch of piñatas, which Matt Stryker was quick to explain by informing us that they were there for the huge after party that I guess they had planned that night. I wish I could have been at that after party. Mac's piñata had a wrench inside of it. Cage grabbed the piñata, cracked it open, and inside he only found candy. I would rather get candy than a wrench, but, you know, then again, I'm not in the middle of a fucking fight, so Cage is. And in the classic game of candy versus wrench, wrench always wins, so he got clobbered in the midsection with it. So between, let's see here, we have piñatas, we have Final Deletion, we have Bret Hart getting pissed off at Triple H over a video game. This is officially the weirdest sound-off I've ever done. Mac put Cage on top of a table. He walked up into the bleachers. And he climbed up onto the railing. And he delivered a frog splash onto Cage through the table. How many feet up he was, if I had to guess, he was probably, I mean, he was probably every bit of, you know, 10 feet or so up. It was a good height. And Mac is a big dude. I mean, this guy's every bit of 300 plus pounds. And he crashed on top of Cage through this table. And somehow, that only got a two count. Here's the problem I had with this match. This should have won the whole damn thing. Cage kicks out. And I figure, okay, well, if he kicked out of that, that must mean Cage is winning. Or at least they've got some big plan, stunt or something planned for the finish. Nope. 2 minutes later, Cage goes to curb stomp Mac on a cinder block. He slips on beer that Mac had spilled earlier in the match on the floor. And he gets schoolboyed for the pin. The match ends on a slip on a banana peel finish. How is that frog splash through the table not the finish? It's like, what the hell? It bugged the shit out of me. It bugged the hell out of me. It's like, so Mac was winning the match anyway, and he won on a fucking roll-up like 90 seconds later. Why could he not just win with the frog splash? The whole place was going, holy shit. It was an incredible move. It was an incredible spot. It would have been a nice capper after all the abuse that these guys took in this match. It was like, I don't know. These guys busted their asses. They had a wild match. You know, thumbs up to them. Mac advances to the finals later in the show. I don't know. It bothers me. It shouldn't, but it does. Tejano and Son of Havoc, they're in the ring for the next match in the tournament. And again, Dario Cueto comes out. He points out that there is a makeshift bar at ringside. An actual bar. We're not talking about a bar like you would see at a gym or a bar that you would whack someone over the head with. A bar with liquor. And Dario says this match will now be a Boyle Heights bar fight. So a chant of "We want beer" broke out here at one point. And really, who doesn't want beer? Tejano, I don't expect a "We want salad" chant here in the temple. Although I guess that could have a different meaning. Tejano had put some bar stools in the ring, which I guess at some point here they got shattered. I didn't see how, but there was a pile of wood, and you saw the legs and the wood chips and everything. Son of Havoc gave Tejano a Hurricane Rana off the top rope, and Tejano landed back first right on all the wood, the pile of wood, the debris. Oh my god, I mean, I hope it was some kind of like cardboard or something, because that was just, that was an unnecessary bump to take. This entire match was whole, just one giant unnecessary bump. Havoc backdropped Tejano off the apron into the bar. He shattered the whole thing, glass everywhere, his back is all cut up. Havoc took some of the broken glass in the ring, or there was some like glass bottles and he stomped on them like a fucking Jewish wedding or something. He's stomping on this, now we have broken shards of glass in the ring, and he slams Tejano onto it. Again, his back is all bloodied and cut up. I figured it was like sugar glass or something, but I don't think sugar glass cuts you up like that. I mean, I'm no stuntman, so, you know, you guys may know more about that than I do, but either way, Tejano took some really sick bumps in this match. Son of Havoc got the win. So it was Mac against Son of Havoc in the finals in a Falls Count Anywhere match, yet another one. Son of Havoc won with a Shooting Star Press off the top. This only went a few minutes. It didn't have the crazy bumps and the insanity of the earlier matches, so I thought this fell flat. I thought coming after those first two matches was a big mistake. It just felt like, you know, when he got the pin, it's like, that's it? So I thought this was disappointing. Dario came out with two briefcases, and one was $250,000 cash that Havoc could just take right now. Or he could choose the other briefcase, which contained a contract for a Lucha Underground title shot at next year's Ultima Lucha. Now, any rational human being like you or I would take the money and run. Not Son of Havoc. He's a dumb babyface. So, of course, not only did he choose the contract, he trusted that Dario Cueto would do the right thing. And as soon as he chose the contract, Dario said, well, on second thought, you got one more match you have to win. And that's when Famous B walked out to introduce his newest client, Dr. Wagner Jr., a legend of Lucha Libre. Dr. Wagner Jr., he has wrestled for AAA, for CMLL. He's got over 30 years in the business, they told us. Guy's 50 years old. Pretty good shape for a 50-year-old, I have to say. And if he wins this match, he gets the $250,000 cash, and Son of Havoc is left with nothing. His dick in his hand, basically. So like I said, dumb babyface. Of course he lost in about 2 minutes. He lost to a Michinoku driver, Famous B celebrating with the money, and that's how the show ends. So this was a damn good show overall. These guys took some hellacious bumps, but they were fighting for a unique opportunity, right? So it kind of made sense. These guys would pull out all the stops. I just wish they didn't, kill themselves quite as much as they did. But I thought the first two matches just were a couple of insane brawls, and the last match suffered because of it. But week one was very enjoyable. I expect week two to be even better. I like how they've divided it up, so we get three big shows out of it instead of one or two. Let's get to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Robert from Orlando. I remember back a few years ago when Triple H was on Raw in a match against Curtis Axel. Something happened and he was taken to the back. Did he almost die? What happened? I've been confused about it ever since it happened. I got this email from Robert. I had to pull it and use it on the show, but I got this email from him with the subject line, Triple H near death. This was not what I was expecting. Thankfully, this was not what I was expecting. We can't have anything bad to happen to, you know, NXT, so don't scare me like that. It was the match with Brock Lesnar, if I'm remembering correctly. He had just had a match with him. It might have been the last match, which was the cage match that they had. And I think in storyline, Triple H suffered a concussion. He went out there and wrestled anyway. And, you know, it was like the angle they did with Shawn Michaels many years ago on Raw when he wrestled Owen Hart. And he collapsed from post-concussion syndrome. It was kind of similar in a way. They were playing it up as real and it was done to feel real and make you believe that he was suffering from the effects of the concussion. But it was all just an angle. He was not dying. Sal in San Antonio, how legit was Daniel Bryan's firing in 2010? He got in trouble for choking Justin Roberts with his own tie and fired 4 days after the incident. It always seemed like he was... Was it 4 days? I thought it was like within a day or so. It always seemed like he was eventually going to come back. It was more like a suspension than a firing. If WWE had to appease sponsors, wouldn't those same sponsors have been angry when he returned just 2 months later? Well, I think you nailed it right on the head. It really, if you think about it, it was more like a suspension. The big difference being it was an unpaid suspension. That was probably the biggest difference. You're not getting paid anymore if you're fired. I'm sure Brian talks about it in his book, which I still have to read. I really need to get on that, so... my advice to you would be to check out the book if he has more details to share. That's where it would be. Rolando from the Bronx, how come WWE didn't choose Shawn Michaels as King of the Ring instead of Mabel in 1995. Yeah, it's funny. When I remember watching that in my younger days, and I was so annoyed when Shawn Michaels and Kama went to the time limit draw, because I thought for sure Shawn's winning this whole thing, right? He had just come back. He was off for a couple months, and he was the biggest star in that tournament, aside from maybe, I think The Undertaker was in there. But he goes to a time limit draw in the first round with Kama, and I'm like, are you kidding me? And then, of course, they had Mabel win. Not one of the better King of the Ring winners, to say the least. That whole tournament, really, was one of the worst. But, you know, the idea there, they wanted to create a monster heel challenger for Diesel, and it didn't work out. That SummerSlam main event that year sucked. Were it not for doing the Shawn Razor ladder match, which was a change from the original plan, because originally it was, I think, going to be Shawn and Sid just one-on-one for the title. And they probably looked at the card, and they looked at the main event, and they said, boy, this is going to suck. We got to put something on here. And it was, like, last minute. I mean, maybe not that week, but it was a change to do Shawn and Razor in a rematch from Mania 10 to do the ladder match over again. And it saved the show because it was a great match. But they wanted to make a monster heel. Shawn came back as a babyface. He was not a heel. And Diesel was the big babyface champion. And they didn't want to, I imagine that they did not want to do babyface against babyface. Again, this is my opinion here. I don't know this is fact, but I'm looking at it and I'm going, why the hell would they not have Shawn win the tournament and get the title match? Because they didn't want to do the match. It was too early for that. So they went with, you know, the big guy to make the big heel monster challenger. And, you know, we got the main event that we got. But we also, out of it, got a great ladder match between Shawn and Razor. So in the end, yeah, it worked out pretty well. Leonard from Los Angeles, who do you think is the best pure athlete you've ever seen in wrestling? I personally think it's either Shelton Benjamin or Apollo Crews. I would like to hear your opinion. Shelton Benjamin was a hell of an athlete, but the best pure athlete I've ever seen in wrestling is Brock Lesnar. Kurt Angle is up there with him. He's up there. But Brock is the best I've ever seen. And the scary thing about Brock, you know, you mentioned Shelton, and the two of them were roommates in college. The scary thing is that at his size, Brock could do pretty much everything that Shelton could do. Now, you know, you can find a move here and there maybe that he couldn't do, but by and large, Brock could do all of the same stuff. Brock is, he's scary fast for a guy his size. Okay, even still, today, he is deceptively quick. He's got brute strength. One of the most memorable moments for me was the first time I ever saw him pick up Big Show for the F5 at Survivor Series. And I think in that same match, he gave Big Show a belly-to-belly suplex. He's a guy's a freak of nature. He is ungodly strong. And I know, you know, he almost killed himself trying to do the shooting star at WrestleMania, but he was hitting shooting star presses. Okay, picture-perfect shooting stars in dark matches and in OVW way before WrestleMania. So it's kind of a shame that that's all people are going to remember of him in that move, because he was hitting those things like they were nothing. And a guy his size should not be able to hit a shooting star press. Okay, and look at what he's accomplished. NCAA champion, he goes to pro wrestling, he tries his hand at the NFL, he goes to UFC, he becomes UFC heavyweight champion, he comes back to UFC after a 5-year layoff, he's dominant in his first fight back against somebody, you know, Mark Hunt, who's no slouch. How many people can say that they've done all the things that Brock has done? No one. There isn't anybody except Brock. He is the best pure athlete in wrestling that I've ever seen, and everybody else is fighting for second place. Speaking of Shawn Michaels in 1995, Tariq from Philadelphia, what was the heat between Shawn Michaels and Bam Bam Bigelow back in 95? When the Click was running things behind the scenes, I heard they ran him out of there. Also, why isn't Bam Bam in the Hall of Fame? Best working big man of all time. I do think Bam Bam, he is eventually going to get into the Hall of Fame, although I would go with Vader or The Undertaker ahead of him as the greatest big man. Do yourself a favor and find the shoot interview that Bam Bam did many years ago. It had to be the early, maybe even the mid-2000s. He was sitting in like a video store somewhere, and it's a 3-hour, it's over 3 hours. It's a long shoot interview. The full thing is up on YouTube. In that shoot, he mentioned Shawn and Diesel having beef with him because Bam Bam's match with Lawrence Taylor was slotted ahead of theirs at WrestleMania 11. So whatever heat there may have been, I think, stemmed from that, at least according to him. You know, they were making comments to him. It was very obvious they were bothered by the fact that he was being positioned as the main event and not them. They were in the championship match. So I think it's safe to say it probably comes from there, or that didn't help if they already didn't like the guy. Now, it's stupid, of course, because it's not like it was Bigelow's fault. I mean, what are they going to do, though? What are Shawn and Diesel going to do? Are they going to start to bully Vince McMahon, who made the call? Of course not. Of course not. Bigelow doesn't have very many nice things to say about the Click and what they were doing at the time. He's not the only one. So it's one of those situations where I think as more people come out and tell stories about what was going on at the time, it becomes less and less likely that they're just... it's just sour grapes. I think where there's smoke, there's fire. I'm sure the Click was throwing their weight around and doing a lot of really, bad things at the time and flexing their muscle. And, you know, it was like they ran the place. Strength in numbers. And they knew, Shawn knew, he's a big enough star. He could probably get away with stuff that Bam Bam couldn't, or, Skip of the Body Donnas couldn't, or Jannetty couldn't, and people like that. It's just, you hear him talk about the Click, though, and just the people they would fuck with. Chris Candido, I mentioned him, right? They fucked with him so bad, that guy. And Bigelow, I remember in that shoot, Bigelow told a story about once, I don't know if it was him or the other boys, they found a note in Candido's bag once. Why they were going into his bag, I don't know. But knowing the stories from back then, maybe they were looking for pills or something. But they were going, you know, in his bag, and they found a note in Candido's bag that it almost read like a suicide note. You know, I mean, he was so depressed, and things were going on with Tammy and Shawn Michaels, and he knew, you know, he knew what was going on. It was just crazy. But it's worth tracking down that interview. It's long, but it's pretty insightful. Emmanuel from Chicago. Apparently there exists a promotional poster for Vader versus the Ultimate Warrior at In Your House, It's Time. Warrior's 1996 WWF run was supposedly meant to build towards a match with Shawn Michaels at Survivor Series, which would lead to Warrior getting his second championship reign, where he would have defended it against Vader in the aforementioned match. Have you ever heard of this, and do you believe that there is any truth to it? That In Your House, let's see, It's Time would have been December of 96. I think that was the last show of the year. If I'm right, if that is the timeline here, then I don't buy it. I don't buy it. Warrior was gone. He was gone, let's see. He was gone in late June. Late June, early July, I think, is when Warrior left or got fired or whatever happened. I know in the self-destruction of the Ultimate Warrior DVD that they did, that hit piece on him, they mocked up a fake poster. I think it was for a house show match between Warrior and Vader. I don't think it was for a pay-per-view match. They mocked up a fake poster. I'm pretty sure it was a fake. That whole DVD was just a hit piece on the guy, so it's not shocking that they would do something like that. My understanding is that Vader was supposed to wrestle Shawn Michaels for the title at Survivor Series, and he was going to win it there. I think Jim Cornette has said the same thing, and he was Vader's manager, so... Not only was he Vader's manager, by that point in 96, Cornette may well have been part of management and creative. So I trust that he knows what he's talking about when he says that the plan had been for Vader to win the title at Survivor Series. Obviously, that didn't happen. They went with Sid instead. I doubt there was ever any plan for the Warrior to beat Shawn at Survivor Series. Vader, yes, but not the Warrior. Jamie from Waterloo, Ontario. I was recently listening to Ric Flair's podcast with Sting that I came across on YouTube. During the podcast, Flair makes a comment that Sting was so over back in the 80s. If he had gone to WWF instead, there would have been no Hulk Hogan. I find this laughable, as I think Sting would not have even been near a top star in WWF with Hogan running wild. What are your thoughts? Yeah, I heard that comment at the time because I heard the interview. And, you know, having had more time to think about it, I would agree. You put both of them in that company at the same time. Hogan is still a number one. I don't think that changes. Now, I disagree that Sting, you say Sting wouldn't have even been near Hogan. He wouldn't have been that much of a top star. That I disagree with. I think that with the WWF marketing machine behind him, and he had a very marketable look, Sting did with the face paint and everything and the colorful outfits, I think he would have been a big star. But he would not have taken Hogan's spot. Because, you know, here's the thing. First of all, as big as Sting was, okay, physically, I'm not talking about popularity, as big as this guy was, he wasn't as big as Hulk Hogan was. And the minute that Vince sees Hogan, let's say he's already got Sting, Sting's a big star, the minute that Vince lays eyes on Hulk Hogan, he's not taking a backseat to Sting. It's just not happening. Size was a big deal back then, way more than it is now. So Hogan still had that going for him. But also, I would argue that Sting may have been a better wrestler than Hogan. He was a lot more dynamic in the ring, and he could fly around and do stuff that you would never see Hogan doing. But it's not like he was such a better worker than Hogan, because between the two of them, there really wasn't that much of a difference. I mean, again, I'd give the edge slightly to Sting, but it's as far as like in-ring performers, you know, I mean, there wasn't that much of a difference between them. So what gives Hogan the edge is the charisma. Hogan oozed charisma. I mean, Sting was a charismatic guy too, to a point, but his promos were nothing special. I mean, he went, you know, it's not like he had to go out there and you know, give speeches every week, but take a Sting promo from the late 80s, early 90s and put it next to a Hogan promo, like when Hogan was all coked up and doing a real Hulk Hogan promo back in the day. Hogan was a madman. He was out of his mind. That's one of the reasons the Ultimate Warrior got over so much. People mock and make fun of his promos and they didn't make any sense, and rocket ships and fuel and aliens and shit, but you know what? That's a big part of what got the Ultimate Warrior over as a star. It wasn't his fucking work. It was his look. It was the muscles. It was the paint. And it was the promos, because he was a freaking madman. Hogan was kind of like that, and he wasn't as crazy as the Warrior, but Hogan had some pretty out there promos. You know, I mean, go back and watch some of them. He had some promos that you would watch, and you would just think to yourself, what the hell is this guy on? You know, and he's all amped up, and he's just a ball of energy. Sting didn't have that. And that's a big part of what made Hulk Hogan so popular back in the day. And again, like I said, whether it was the drugs or whatever, his promos, his verbal skills are what helped him get over. That's what got people's attention. That and what's the other thing, right? What was the whole thing he was marketed around? 24-inch pythons. Sting was a strong guy. Sting was actually a lot bigger in the mid-80s than he was in the late 80s. His physical peak was before he actually became popular in WCW, but Sting didn't have 24-inch pythons like Hogan. So it was the promos and the pythons. That's what got Hogan over as the top star in the business. So there's no way Sting would have carried things the way that Hogan did. If you had them side by side, I still think Vince is going with Hogan. I don't see it. Like what Flair said about there would be no Hogan, I don't see it. I don't think that's the case. Jared from the UK, I wanted to know if you knew much about the ending of the Cena-Lesnar match from Extreme Rules 2012. Having just watched it today for about the 7th time, I had a question to run by you. After the match, Cena seemed visibly pissed off and proceeded to grab a mic and tell everybody that he was taking a vacation. I wondered if you knew the backstory behind this. Why exactly was he supposed to be taking a vacation? Because in the end, he never actually took one. Yeah, that was a weird one. I think Brock was legitimately upset about that backstage, because there were a lot of reports and news items about that he pitched a fit in the back, and why is... I just beat the hell out of this guy. Why is he cutting a promo out in front of the ring? He should be carried out of there. And he's right. You know, if that's true and Brock was upset, he has every right to be upset, because Cena won the match. Brock beat the shit out of him. He bloodied him up. He tried to break his arm. Cena was selling an arm injury. Cena, I can't picture John Cena going out on a stretcher. I'm not saying that, but at the very least, when the match was over, he should have just saluted the crowd and had two referees on each arm helping him to the back. And instead, he's out there. He's on the mic. This is like something that would normally be dark in the building, but this aired on TV. And the ring steps are in the ring. He's sitting on the ring steps, and he's just cutting a promo, get home safe. It's like, what the hell is this? You know, so I can understand Brock being upset. The whole thing about the vacation, I don't know if it was a case of him selling the fact that he, you know, his arm was fucked, which he was. His arm was kind of at his side. I don't know if he was just selling it or if he really thought maybe his arm was fucked and in the end, you know, the injury wasn't as bad. Because I know he was wearing a sling for a few weeks after that. So that I don't know. I don't know if it was, if he actually thought he was hurt or if he was just selling the injury. But the vacation comment was, I'm going to have to take time off to heal up my arm. I mean, that's what it was from. Jake says, if Bret Hart had stayed with WWE in 1997, do you think Stone Cold Steve Austin would have gotten his big push? Do you think he would have faced Bret for the title at WrestleMania 14? Austin still would have become the face of the company. I don't think Bret staying would have affected that. And I do think Bret dropping the title to him at WrestleMania 14 would have made a great story, right? 1 year later after their WrestleMania match, he finally puts him over, which Bret didn't. I mean, I can't remember Bret doing a clean job for Steve Austin. He sings Austin's praises. He has nothing but great things to say about him. They're still friends to this day, but he never put him over, like, clean in the middle. Now, had Montreal not happened, and he stuck around, and WrestleMania comes, and Bret's going to drop the title to him, then he would have. But it never happened. It's like Austin and Rock. They had a lot of great matches. You can count on one hand the number of times that Stone Cold put the Rock over clean in the middle. In fact, I think it might have only happened one time, which was Austin's last match, and he knew it was his last match, so of course he was going to lose. So, but it's funny because, you know, Rock and Austin were big stars, and they did trade wins back and forth, but in terms of, like, clean in the middle, I don't know. I don't know what it was, but Austin never did for The Rock until his retirement match. So, again, it wouldn't have affected Austin's push. Now, here's the thing. I'm sure that Shawn Michaels would have found some way to kind of fuck all that up or work his way into the main event of WrestleMania that year. This is assuming that, you know, he didn't suffer the back injury, which didn't happen until January. But funny thing about that is, if Shawn Michaels did kind of worm his way into the main event and made it like a three-way, he probably would have made an even better match. So I'm not complaining like, oh, that would have been a terrible match. It would have been a great match. But there's no way that Shawn is letting Bret Hart get that main event spot at WrestleMania without him being part of it somehow. So politically, I think it would have been very interesting to see how things would have shaken out, because you could say, oh, Bret versus Austin, this would have made sense. But don't forget, Shawn Michaels, Mr. I don't lay down for anybody, he's still on that roster. And if he's healthy and you're going into WrestleMania, you know he's not going to take anything but the main event. Travis from Meadville, Pennsylvania. I wanted to ask you about the triple threat at SummerSlam in 1999 and the Triple H situation. Triple H won the right to face the WWF champion a month earlier at Fully Loaded. In the build-up to that match, however, the number one contender changed multiple times. First it was Triple H, then it was China. Mankind then became number one contender, but it ended up being a triple threat with Mankind and Triple H challenging Austin. And then in the match, Mankind won the title only to drop it the next night to Triple H. It seems as if the initial plan was to do Triple H against Stone Cold for the belt, with Triple H going over, but for some reason, everything got changed. Now, I've heard everything from Austin not wanting to play ball and put him over, to Jesse Ventura not wanting to raise a heel's hand in the match. Just wanted to see if you knew anything more. I don't have anything conclusive for you. Only, you know, the only people who know are the ones who were involved, but I think it just had to do with the fact that Jesse was the governor of the state, and I don't know if Jesse had a problem with it, but I don't think they necessarily wanted the governor raising the heel's hand at the end of the show. Maybe they were going for more of a kind of a feel-good moment, even though the show didn't go off the air with a feel-good moment because Austin got left laying by Triple H. So that's why part of me doesn't really buy the whole theory of, well, Austin just didn't want to put Triple H over and this and that. Because if Austin had a problem with Triple H and putting him over, you know, they could have just had Triple H beat Mankind. That's the benefit of a three-way match. Austin doesn't even have to take the losing fall. And he did. He took the pin in this match. It's not like Foley ever had a problem putting Triple H over before. I'm sure he would have gladly done it. Not only did they not do that, but the pay-per-view went off the air with Triple H beating Austin down. So, to me, that whole theory doesn't make any sense. Jay from Florida. What do you know about Vicky Askew, Vince McMahon's mother? I never hear her name mentioned on any WWE programming. I hear about his father, Vince Sr., and mentions here and there of his grandfather, Jess McMahon, every now and then, but nothing about the mom. Can you shed any light on this? I don't know very much about Vince McMahon's mother. I know that she is still alive. I believe she would be about 95 years old. She's in her mid-90s. I know that. I think she's at a home somewhere. It's a really weird situation. Because Vince McMahon, he did an interview once with Playboy magazine. And he was also, he's done other interviews, but the Playboy one is the one that I remember. Because I remember grabbing a copy of Playboy. Because, you know, back then I would read Playboy for the articles. And I couldn't wait to see the interview with Vince. And there's a part of the interview, and I'm sure it's online somewhere, where he talks about his upbringing as a kid. And there's a mention of him being sexually molested. And if I'm remembering correctly, when they try to kind of pry him on that and find out what that's all about, he mentions that it wasn't on the male side of the family, and it was like, I'll leave it at that. And I think maybe they pushed him more on it, and they asked him, would it be safe to say, like, did it have to do with your mom? And he gave some kind of answer like, that would be safe to assume. So I know he had a stepmom who I think, I don't know if she's around anymore. I think she may have died, but it sure sounded like he was talking about his mom doing things to him sexually when he was a kid. Now, and that would it might explain some things about his personality, because I don't know. Vince is a weird guy, but here's the thing that is weird to me. I remember there being a story. This goes back, it could go back 10 years now. It's a while ago. But there was a story of Vince McMahon buying his mother some kind of, like, a tennis center, or there was a tennis, because I guess she's like an avid tennis player, or she was. Maybe she's not playing tennis at 95, but either he bought one for her, or he had it renamed in her honor. And I remember thinking to myself, if this woman did things to him like he kind of alluded to in that interview with Playboy, it's kind of weird that they seem to be on good terms now. Maybe something happened and, you know, forgive and forget. Who knows? To each their own. But I thought that was weird, because the whole thing was, you're estranged from your mother. And my understanding was he was always estranged from her. And it may well have been because of these things that I just mentioned. But yet there was a story about him naming some tennis center in her honor. And I know he's gone on Twitter on Mother's Day and wished his mom a happy Mother's Day. It's just very weird. It's very weird. So my knowledge is limited. It's probably what you guys have heard. You've probably heard the same things. That just sounds like a whole weird thing to me. And yeah, that's it. That's all I know. That's all I know about it. Justin Goodman, you have an unlimited amount of money, an unlimited amount of pay-per-view time, and the option of any arena in the world. You have to create the perfect WWF versus WCW pay-per-view at the height of the Attitude Era. What does that show look like? Now, I don't like doing these fantasy booking questions. I don't do them very often, but Justin, he contributed to the show, and I was kind of interested to see what this might look like, so I was thinking about it. Forget arenas, I would book a big stadium, because as hot as wrestling was back then, you could, believe me, if you're doing the WWF versus WCW supercard at the height of the Attitude Era, like the late 90s, you could fill a stadium. So I would book a stadium, and my card would look like this. Austin versus Goldberg has to be the main event. Those were the two biggest stars in each of those companies at that point. I know Sting was hot for a while, but then Goldberg came along. And so if we're looking at like 98, the biggest match you could have done was Steve Austin against Bill Goldberg. So that would be the main event. And I would do this. You know, DX and the NWO were pretty big staples of each of their companies. And, you know, DX was a takeoff of the NWO. And I think doing a DX versus NWO, like a six-man tag, would have been kind of cool. But I would have done it with the original three. Now, I know at like the height of the Attitude Era by that point, I think Hogan and Hall and Nash, you know, the NWO had become such a bloated group, and then Hogan was feuding with Nash. It was like NWO Wolfpack and NWO Black and White. And so I'm using some creative license here, but I would go with the original three, Hogan, Hall, and Nash, and I would put them against Shawn Michaels, Triple H, and X-Pac. And you could even play off the fact that X-Pac had been a member of the NWO before jumping ship to DX, and I would put together that as a six-man tag, DX against the NWO. And again, Shawn, I know he had back surgery. Let's pretend that that didn't happen. I would do Undertaker and Sting. I would do Rock against DDP. And you could do the whole People's Champ versus People's Champ thing. And this is the other match I threw in here, because this is a match that intrigues me a lot. I would do the Macho Man, Randy Savage, against Mankind. And I would do it in a street fight. I just think those two guys could have a hell of a brawl. I think Savage, especially at that point, Savage is just a madman. Foley, we know he's out of his mind. We know the kind of bumps he would take. I could just picture those two guys brawling all over the building, you know, and just having a wild, all-out brawl. So I would want to see that match. That would round out the top of the card, and then you'd have to flush it out with, you know, the undercard stuff and the cruiserweight guys and all that. I'm not going to get into that, but I think that would be a hell of a card. And you can't go wrong. Everybody who hears this is going to have their own opinion on what that card would look like. Oh, you should do Hogan against Austin, and you should do Rock against Sting, and you can't go wrong with any of those combinations. It would have been huge. It would have been absolutely huge. And that's kind of what bothers me about the whole invasion thing, and why they couldn't, you know, at least initially get some more big names. I understand, you know, some guys just want to sit at home and they have their contracts and they want to collect their money, and that's cool. But I don't believe that had they put in the extra effort and paid the money, they could have bought out at least some of those contracts, and they could have started building. You know, WrestleMania 18 could have been what you just described. Now, it wasn't the height of the Attitude Era. Some of the matches would have looked different at that point. But if you wanted to build to a real WWF versus WCW supercard, you had the time to build it up at WrestleMania 18 in Toronto. So there's a stadium show. That could have been it. And they just fucked the whole thing up. And lastly here, Devian from Odessa, Texas. Buy or sell Mike Tyson in WWE or Karl Malone and Dennis Rodman in WCW? Which was more significant? Mike Tyson. I'm buying on Tyson, selling on the other two. Are you kidding me? You cannot understate the impact that Mike Tyson had on WWF and on Steve Austin. Now, Steve Austin was going to be a big star anyway. But I'll tell you what, it didn't hurt to have him linked up with Mike Tyson. And I still remember to this day all the local news stations playing that Austin Tyson pull-apart brawl on Raw. Now, Karl Malone and Dennis Rodman, they got, you know, a decent amount of publicity too. They were on The Tonight Show. I still remember that one NBA, was it the finals? I guess it would have been the finals. And Rodman and Malone were opposite each other in the NBA finals, in the playoffs. And there was one part in the game where it's almost like they were fighting on the court. They tripped over each other. They were fighting over a ball. And I think it was Bob Costas, that prick. He made it some kind of really snide, like sarcastic, nasty comment about wrestling. And why would these guys lower themselves? You know, because he's the paragon of virtue over here. I remember that just annoyed the shit out of me. So, but here are these two guys who are now signed with WCW. They're in the NBA playoffs, you know, on NBC or whatever it was. And, you know, it wasn't a positive mention, but at least they mentioned that they were doing wrestling. So it's not like they didn't get a lot of publicity, but Rodman and Malone, you know, WCW was already at its peak point, you know, 97, 98. They didn't need Dennis Rodman or Karl Malone. WWF, they made a play for Mike Tyson. They paid him millions of dollars. They brought him in and it paid off. It was almost like their Mr. T moment of the modern era. Mr. T was a very important part of that first WrestleMania and getting Hogan over to a mainstream audience. I mean, Hogan would not have gotten on Saturday Night Live were it not for Mr. T being there with him. So they got a ton of publicity. That first WrestleMania turned out to be a success, and at that point, they were off to the races. They didn't need Mr. T at that point, although he stuck around. And it was kind of a similar, I think, in that more modern era in the late 90s, that's what Tyson was to WWF. Tyson still had a name. I mean, you could say he was past his prime, but he was still a big-time pay-per-view draw. And this was coming off the Holyfield bite in the ear and everything in 97. And him and the image of him with Austin and then him raising Austin's hand at the end of WrestleMania, that was a big, big deal. And that meant a hell of a lot more to WWF than the other guys did to WCW. It was nice to have them, and it got them publicity, but they didn't need them. WCW was already number one. WWF was fighting to get back to number one, and Tyson was a big part of that. So that's going to do it. I think that's a big enough mailbag. We'll wrap it up and open it back up next week. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle. Don't forget to vote in our post-Raw poll. It goes up every Monday night as soon as Raw goes off the air. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Buy a shirt in our Pro Wrestling Tee store, prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. This would be a good time, by the way, if you're planning on joining us for the meetup in Brooklyn on August 21st. It's a few hours before SummerSlam. We're going to be hitting up the KBH, which is a beer hall in Brooklyn, only a few blocks away from the arena. I hope to see many of you there. If you want to buy a Sound Off shirt and maybe wear it to the meetup, it sometimes takes a few weeks to get the shirt. So I'm just saying, if you wanted to, now would be a good time to buy one instead of waiting until the last minute. You could also make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com if you want to show your support that way. You are more than welcome to do so and get yourself a shout out here on the show, which is available across multiple platforms: iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Audio Boom, Google Play Music, just a host of different ways to get this show. We have a free app in the Google Play Store. It's another way you can listen. You can stream us in the Podbean app, all of which is free. You don't have to pay for it. So keep spreading the word, and I very much appreciate all of your support. We'll be back next weekend, 450. Wow, can't believe it. Episode 450 already. That'll be next weekend. That'll be the final episode before the draft. So until then, be well, stay safe, thank you as always, and we will see you right back here for a brand new podcast next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
I'm just saying, I don't know, with New Day, you got three black guys out there. Why Francesca?
You want to call it Tyrone the Trombone?
Okay. That's racist.
Well, no, it's...
Racist, no.
I'm not racist. Go to Hulk Hogan for that. That's not me.
You know, usually the people that go, I'm not racist, that those are the racists.
Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.